Tonight's episode of Shockwaves is dedicated to Kevin Watkins. He was a listener, but more than that, he was a friend. You will be missed.
Fright Rags has been giving you the best in horror apparel and accessories since 2003, offering hundreds of products for fan-favorite films. This week, they want you to obey and consume its They Live collection, featuring new shirts, classic reprints, and socks. Also this week, the triumphant return of the Tea of Mystery. You choose your size, and we will send you a random shirt shrouded in a black package so its contents are completely unknown to all who hold it. Only $9 and in limited supply, so grab yours while they last. Available exclusively at fright-rags.com. Shockwaves listeners get 10% off when they use the code SHOCKWAVES2020.
Tonight's episode of Shockwaves is brought to you by Fangoria.com. It's a little crazy out there right now, so Fangoria is offering a free 2-month digital membership to everyone. Go to Fangoria.com for more information and to make an account. Then pore over all the exclusive articles, interviews, and reviews on the site, as well as original video content and podcasts. You'll even have access to high-resolution scan of the first 15 original issues of the Fangoria magazine run, and counting. Go to Fangoria.com now and start your free digital membership. And if you're looking to add to your social distancing watch list, Fangoria's latest movie, VFW, is now available to stream on demand, and Satanic Panic is now streaming on Shudder.
Holy smokes, here we are, episode 185 of Shockwaves, and I think we are all on. This is Rob G. I'm gonna do voices because people are confusing our voices and thought that Ryan recommended He Never Died when it was me, damn it. So this is the voice of Rob G. Ryan Turek, what do you sound like?
This is the deep baritone of Ryan Turek.
There it is. No mistaking that whatsoever. Rebecca McKendry?
I'm the girl.
I thought you were the Kiwi. You sure?
I want to be the girl. Come on.
There you go. Elric's the girl. That's the voice of Elric Cade. Mm-hmm. And right off the top, we've got a very special guest with us, which we're very excited about.
One of the advantages
of doing this all remotely is that we can connect with people from other part of the world. This is the faraway land known as New York. Mr. Michael Gingold is with us.
Hey, everyone.
Oh man, it's great to see you.
So Rob, you and I mean, like, Mike, Rob and I go, and Becca go way, way back, thanks to the Fangoria days.
Yeah. Elric's not part of that club.
though I did meet him at a screening of Abby somewhere in New York State with my friend Webb. One time. So we have met in person one time.
Mike doesn't know this, but whenever I had an assignment for Fangoria, I always took a lot of glee in handing in my assignment, knowing that Mike was going to go through it with a fine-tooth comb.
Thank you.
He is such a good editor. Oh my God. Mike made me sound brilliant.
Michael's the best editor I've ever worked with
He really is.
The subtle thing is this. You could submit a piece that was like, whatever, 1,500 words, and Mike would only change like 4 of those words and somehow make it 10 times better. Like, he just knew how to tweak it just right, where you're like, wow, I sound way smarter.
I mean, you guys made it easy.
No, it was all like sentence restructuring, which I still like. You have this art for it where I would literally hand you sentences and you would just swap 2 of the words and I'd suddenly be like, oh, I sound good now. But I don't know if Mike even realizes it, but he is the reason that I started working at Fangoria to begin with.
Really?
I don't even know if you remember this, Mike, because it was so long ago, but you and I met at the Horror Film Festival. And I had been pulled in to host a panel there. I was just doing like the intro. I wasn't like moderating, but they just had me intro it and outro it because somebody had not shown up. This was Michael Hines last year doing it.
Oh, maybe.
And May he rest in peace. And I was, I had only been in New York for maybe 3 weeks at the time. And I volunteered at the festival because I had no money. And I wanted to see all the movies. And I had done the intro and the outro from it. And you came up to me afterwards and you said, nice job. And I was talking to you and there was a rep there from Rue Morgue as well. And I told you both about how I had just gotten to the city and I was working at a yoga studio and I just wanted to work in horror. And you gave me yours and Tony's email address and told me that you thought there was an opening at the radio station. And
oh, yeah.
That's how everything came to me.
God. Yeah. I remember those.
Yeah,
days.
We go way back on that. Yeah. Oh, my God. Yeah. Years on the radio.
Well, before the Fangoria days, my favorite memories of Michael is they'd always do the Fangoria Weekend of Horrors in New York City and then New Jersey eventually. Yeah. But Michael would kick off the show with the trailer reel. He'd always host the trailers because the first thing they would do in the program is show you trailers, you know, before you can watch all this stuff online. And I remember once, I think it was the trailer, it was the trailer for Leeches. And you were just like, if you're wondering who writes this crap, this one was me.
I like Leeches. It's a fun one.
I still like it too, actually. Yeah. I haven't looked at it in a long time.
My earliest memories of Mike is going to the Fangoria Weekend of Horrors 1990, 91. And Mike was basically the news resource before the fucking internet. Like, you kicked off the show, Tony would do his like keynote speech or whatever, Mike would do the trailer show, and then he would also come out and like talk about what's going on in the horror scene. And I would sit in the front row waiting on every word because I wanted to know what the latest was happening with Texas Chainsaw 3 or whatever was going to come out at the time. So Mike, you were the internet.
Yeah, it's so weird to think back to the days when you couldn't get it on the internet. You had to, we'd find out about it. And then like 2 months later, it would be in the magazine.
So I'm going to do one more Mike Gingold story because it was also one of my favorite Fango memories. So when I first started at Fangoria, we were owned by this company called Mo Green, and it was massive. Like, we had hundreds. This is at the 34th Street office.
Oh, my God. Oh, yeah. I remember Mo Green.
We had hundreds of employees. We owned, like, Speed Racer, and we did all this work with the band Lordy. There were all of these different divisions. And so there was, like, it was a massive, massive, like, multi-level office. And they stuck, I was just an assistant, like just barely there, like 3 days a week. And they stuck me up in the top level in the back. But every couple of days, Mike would bring me all of his screeners. And you always had this box that you put them in. And every couple of days, you would bring me screeners to watch and of stuff. And it's how I discovered a lot of movies from that time period was through those screener copies that you would leave on my desk. So
the good old days of physical screeners.
Right? Oh, yeah. They all came in those little cardboard sleeves. Yeah.
I still have a bunch of the old VHS screeners of stuff that is still not out on DVD. I'm looking at them right now. It's amazing. Wow.
Some good gems in there, probably.
I love it. Well, Mike, I mean, like, we're happy to have you on the show because you've got three mm-hmm. incredible books that have come out within the last
year and a half.
Years, yeah. Year and a half. Ad Nauseam 2, which I have right here. Nice. And then Ad Astra, which is the sci-fi version. But basically, it's a collection of all of your newsprint movie ads from the 80s, 90s, 2000s. And they were printed by 1984. Rue Morgue presented them. But congrats, man. These books are incredible and great resources and just great to have on the bookshelf when you're stuck in isolation and you just want to kind of sit by the window and then look outside and enjoy a good book.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun putting those together. Well, go ahead. I heard someone about to ask something.
Oh, that was me chiming in. I was just going to say that, you know, I was telling the gang when we discussed the books, you know, most of them for me it's a lost art form. We don't have this anymore where you can see multiple ads for movies that are about to come out. It was always such an exciting thing for me growing up. And what I love about your books is because obviously since we're both from New York, it's literally the same ads I saw growing up listing the same theaters I would go to, which was like, I'd always look at the Nassau County kind of ads and stuff. You know, most of us have our own collector quirks. Like I saved all my ticket stubs from concerts and things like that. So was this just something before the books? Was this just something that you compulsively did as a fan? Like the fact that you had all these still, where did that originate?
Well, these are all ads that I saved as they came out. I started collecting them when I was, I guess, 12 years old. And it was just, you know, when you're a kid, you just want to compulsively collect mementos of what you enjoy. And back in starting around 1980, there was not a lot to collect in the horror genre. You might be able to get posters. There were novelizations. Collector's video wasn't even a thing. Cable TV was just starting to come in with movie channels. And so this was kind of an inexpensive way for me to collect mementos of the films that I liked, even though I didn't get to see a whole lot of them because I was too young to see a lot of these things. In fact, that was one reason. It's like when I just started out, I couldn't go see The Brood in the theater because I was 11 or 12, but I could save the ad at least. So, and, you know, being an obsessive kid, I just started collecting every single one I could find. You know, every Friday I would look in the paper and see what was coming out. And that was back in the post-Halloween era when every week almost there's literally something coming out.
That's incredible. That's incredible. Well, we're going to get into these a little bit later, but and kind of dive into some of our favorite memories of ads and TV ads. I mean, I'm going to open the door on TV.
Oh, that's a whole other thing. Yeah. Well,
not just like. That's a whole other thing. Why don't we get into our usual format, just kind of break down what we were watching over the last week. Mike, you know, you're one of our co-hosts this week, so feel free to chime in as well. What have you guys been watching while we've been in week four of isolation?
Oh my gosh, it's coming up on a month, isn't it?
Yeah. We've it's week four. Elric, why don't we okay. start with you, silent partner?
Well, I kicked off by celebrating Corman's birthday this weekend, yes. Which is amazing that he's still kicking and still in pretty good form. And I went with the one that Tarantino had his issue with Steven Scarlatta over, which is Forbidden World, which is one that Tarantino was saying. I couldn't remember which one I liked more between this and what's the other one? They came out, the two other aliens.
Galaxy of Terror.
Galaxy of Terror, right? I couldn't remember which one I preferred. So I jumped into Forbidden World and absolutely loved it. This was actually one of the most fun rewatches I've had of any movie recently. It just is, you know, it's pretty close in some ways to Alien. The worst part about it is actually the alien design itself is probably the least interesting part. It kind of does look like a big black trash bag at times with a head and sharp teeth, and that's kind of fun. But as a kind of sexploitation, spaceploitation movie, I had an utter ball watching this one. Like a cosmic cop basically drops in. They've genetically created this from an experiment, so it wasn't something found on a planet, and it's, you know, it's starting to grow from ooze basically into the creature that it grows in. But it just is, it's a really good time. It's free on Amazon. I thought it was a fun one to rediscover. I think this is the one that James Cameron had been spray painting. I think they used elements of his production design for both those films, but he was spray painting McDonald's Big Mac containers, and you can't unsee it now. Like, if you hear that story before you watch this film, which I remembered Corman telling me that story like 10 years ago was when I heard that story, I couldn't unsee it while watching, because it's just like a wall of these kind of lunch. They almost don't even look like McDonald's, more like lunch canisters. But it's still a really fun film, like, you know, and you just forget about the sheer body of Corman's work, like that he makes films from The Intruder, you know, serious social dramas to things like this that actually have a bit of scale to them. And he just, you know, worked with such great talent, you know, people who could elevate this stuff from something that now you wouldn't even push play on if it was on Amazon. You know, the kind of things made like this now tend to lack some extra quality that they had at that point. So this was a really fun one. I really enjoyed seeing that again.
Yeah, I actually had worked on the... Shout Factory had done Blu-rays and DVDs of Galaxy of Terror, Forbidden World, and Battle Beyond the Stars. And so my friend Buzz Wallach and I did all the interviews for those, but it was such a blur because it was like 25 like crew members, and you'd ask like two questions about each. And so I was convinced that we were like just getting garbage. And then you watch the documentaries on each of them, and because they're like the two best answers, the documentaries are terrific. Like, the one thing I love about especially that era is all the stories of, you know, people like James Cameron and stuff like that who would just be like, hey guys, let's just stay up all night and like make models. And everyone's like, yeah, that sounds like a great idea. Well, like they were like, he just had this weird enthusiasm that would convince you to do things that you never would do. And that's how they came up with things like the styrofoam as the spaceship kind of deal. But yeah, no, these movies are a lot of fun. Yeah. I got to go back to Forbidden World because I don't remember. I confused them all from that era.
It's been a while since I've actually seen those. Long time. I mean, I just remember they used to be on like WPIX Channel 11 out east, and I would just catch glimpses of them, but not the entire thing. So I would just kind of put two and two together of like how the movie actually.
It's funny. I revisited both those movies in the last couple of years, and Galaxy of Terror kind of has the better rep because it has the more shocking scenes like the giant rapist maggot creature.
Yeah, that's what people remember, yeah.
I love that monster so much. I mean, not the giant and the rapey part, but he was always one of my favorite monsters from that time period. I always liked the crab monsters as well, but giant maggot, he was my jam.
But it's also, it has a much better cast. It has Sid Haig and Robert Englund and Ray Walston and Grace Zabriskie. And I think Forbidden World is a much better
great
film.
Score.
I think as a movie, it holds up a lot better.
Yeah.
Because the story of Galaxy of Terror is just kind of not there. It's just a lot of stuff happening.
Yeah.
And it doesn't really hold together. It has moments, but I think Forbidden World is actually better than it's gotten credit for. It kind of, I think it exists in Galaxy of Terror shadow a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got that weird cyborg, which is kind of funny. It looks like his pet, his friend cyborg, which is really goofy, but it works. You know, the great thing about these movies are they hold together by tape somehow. Which
I think that's left over from Battle Beyond the Stars also.
All
right. So that was some Corman love from Elric.
Well, I'm going to mention this one first, Rye, because I know you've been watching it too. Tales from the Loop, which you've been digging, right?
Oh,
so here, man, I didn't even make the connection. I don't even know if you remember this. This is behind the scenes. Years ago, when we were starting to kind of branch out podcasts at Blumhouse, I pitched you on a Dungeons and Dragons-ish one. And I said that I wanted to focus it on a game that was called Tales from the Loop. And then we ended up realizing that we might not be able to get rights and so, or it might be complicated. So we were like, you know let's just do Dungeons and Dragons. And we made Fear Initiative. But Tales from the Loop started as this Dungeons and Dragons-ish game that I had played a couple of times. And it's the one that inspired me to come to you and be like, there's something cool about this. So you got to go back and play the game.
But I thought Tales from the Loop was based on a artist's like portfolio of like weird sci-fi married with American rural.
It's an RPG as well. And so, yeah. What? So it's been a couple of different incarnations, but yeah. I started watching it and I didn't even make the connection because there's a couple of years difference. And, I started watching and I see these, the robots that are just kind of casually sitting there watching everything. And then I was like, I've seen this before. Yeah. And then I realized I hadn't seen it before. I had read it and played it and everything. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it was really cool to kind of see. And as best I can remember, and I don't want to be wrong on this, but there's a chance. The one that I played was set in Scandinavia. Like, it was a Scandinavian thing. But then I think that they moved the game. Like, there became an American version of it. And I think that there was even like a version that you could set in like any town. Like you could take it and change it to your town when you were playing it. But anyway, that's kind of the history of Tales from the Loop. That said, I have loved this. Yeah. It's like everything I love about Amazing Stories and Twilight Zone, but it's almost, at least a couple of the episodes have these kind of kids on bikes feel to them, at least the ones that I've watched so far. It's just the cinematography and the setting is so beautiful. It's in just this snowy landscape.
Yeah, it's like the setting is Ohio?
I thought Minnesota, somewhere where there's a lot of snow.
Exactly, yeah. So, you know, imagine Norman Rockwell, America, unknown time period. It just kind of feels like timeless. You know, not a whole lot of cell phones, but the gist is this small town has a giant sci-fi, like, you know, giant machine built under the town that basically provides most of the jobs to the residents. And the machine makes the impossible possible. So, for instance, the very first episode, you meet a family led by Rebecca Hall, and Rebecca Hall meets her younger self, who has somehow time traveled into her present so they can work out motherly shit. The second episode is kind of a body swap episode, but all the characters, it's an anthology show, but all of the characters are reoccurring. They pop in and pop out of the narrative. Jonathan Pryce is the one who controls and owns the loop. And we haven't actually gotten to into the loop. It's all above ground.
You go down slightly in the first episode, but barely.
You go down, like, it's just like a little. I want to see like kind of like the big macro view of what the loop is.
I keep waiting for them to like open up the door that's like, and here is the other or whatever it is. But yeah, we haven't gotten there yet.
I don't think we'll ever see it. But it's not horror by any means. But there is a level.
I see. It's adjacent.
It's a little. Yeah. I mean, like. It's a little, it definitely gives you there's a level of intensity, but it's rich in just really deep emotion. Like Ciara and I, we watched the first episode and I know she was crying by the end of the first episode. By the end of the second episode, there's kind of a gut punch that you're just like, oh God, I need something happy. I need something fun. So we put on Rick and Morty. And the funny thing is in case you've been listening, I'm on a Rick and Morty tear because I've never seen the show. So we've been binging the heck out of it. But we got to the end of season two, the season finale. And that wound up being a gut puncher. And I was like, what the fuck? So we kept going.
You got to watch substitute it with the cat grooming show on Netflix is my new jam. It's or the cat, the cat show. It's my new thing.
Tales of Becca and Isolation. But Tales from a Loop is definitely, there's something poetic and beautiful. And there's always this like, you know, they can shoot it in a way where you just see this beautiful picturesque field of like, you know, of trees just blowing in the wind. But if you look to the left of the frame, there is just like this kind of weird sci-fi machine just sitting there rusted. And it just feels lived in. Everything just feels lived in and normal. It feels normal, even though you're seeing these very, very abstract things cutting through our society.
Yeah, and these...
But it's a beautiful show.
Yeah, the robots are just part of it. And I mean, when we say robots, I mean, picture them like Star Wars-esque, like giant landwalker type robots.
Yeah, they're like AT-STs.
And they just kind of roam the entire town and nobody thinks twice about it, watching everything. But then they'll break down and they just kind of leave them there so they become part of the landscape. It's just... the whole thing has just been really beautiful. And yeah, I've had to do the same thing. It's like Black Mirror where I can watch an episode and then I have to go, okay, now I'm going to go watch this other thing.
But you would agree it's a little less bleak than
Black Mirror leaves me hating everything that is going on in society and everything about myself and my phone and everything.
There's hope and there's love and there's all of these very, very positive things that we don't usually talk about here on the show.
It's very pensive, but it's almost like a redemption quality to it at the end of every episode. So that's Tales from the Loop.
Tales from the Loop.
And I just looked it up while we were talking. It was an art book first. The art became the RPG. They did make multiple versions of the RPG.
Got it.
And then that is where the show spun out of.
Interesting. Interesting. Okay.
And the show's on Amazon Prime?
The show's on Amazon Prime.
Right. Yeah. So I'm looking at a new Vinegar Syndrome release, a film I'd never even heard of before called Deadline. I don't know if anyone knows.
From
1980.
Do you remember when the guys from Vinegar Syndrome and AGFA, Brett Berg, wrote to me and he said, get ready, the craziest movie you've ever seen is going to be the next thing being put out. Look out for a film called Deadline. Trust me, it's just crazy. I haven't seen it yet. So that was the last I heard, was him saying how crazy it is. So is it crazy?
It's a Canadian movie from 1980, kind of a gem. It follows a guy named Stephen Leslie, who's a huge horror author. And he's this nice guy, but his books have like these very elaborate death sequences and stuff. He's a very thinly veiled Stephen King. And he's got a wife and kids, and his wife and him are kind of a little bit on the outs. And at the beginning of the movie, he goes to give a lecture at some college where they show a scene from his movie, a movie based on one of his books. And those scenes are amazing because they're like the most graphic, like super vibrant red blood sort of sequences. Like, I think the one within the movie is, a goat shows up while a guy's working on his tractor and it's kind of like got an evil listening to it, and like he keeps hearing stuff in the tractor, like, wait, is somebody turning this thing on? And yes, it turns on. It's pretty wild. But then throughout the duration of the movie, because of his kind of turbulent relationship with his wife, he keeps, and because he's always thinking about writing, it keeps morphing into these really hypergraphic debts. Like, he's basically thinking of stuff he wants to write and do, and it's like starting to blend into his world a little bit. And then
you give me cat in the brain vibes.
Yeah, it's pretty wild. And it goes, and you know, it's not necessarily a horror movie because it's somebody that's thinking about horror. And then some really gnarly shit happens within his family that sets off the third act. And that's as much as you should know. But Elric, I'll tell you why you're going to love this. Cause it's got elegant and colorful cinematography by Manfred Guth, who shot The Pit. So this is the same cinematographer as The Pit.
Now we're talking classy exploitation. You should have told me.
Yes.
He was responsible for that old woman in the wheelchair being wheeled out like Benny Hill.
Yeah.
You could forget.
So it's definitely a hidden gem for sure. And there's some really wild, really wild stuff in here. So yeah, Deadline from Vinegar Syndrome. I would consider this, you know, it's always a gamble. This is one of the good gambles with them. So
are they, because I felt I was bummed because I knew it was coming out, but I didn't even put in my order because I assumed they weren't, no one was shipping. But were they shipping these still? Like,
I believe that
I wasn't sure if there's long delays.
Yeah, no, from my understanding, them and all the labels for the most part are still shipping. I know they're running skeleton crews just to keep things safe, but from what my understanding, they're still shipping stuff out. I think the only, like, Diabolik DVD is doing orders, but it's just tough to get the stuff from the UK right now. So Arrow stuff might be a little tougher, but Vinegar Syndrome still open for business as far as I know.
Cool. No, I've been excited. Anytime I get a tip on something I haven't even heard of, which is rare with the VHS covers, I usually feel like I've seen, even if I haven't seen the film, I feel like I've seen most VHS covers at a certain point, and that one I hadn't, that one didn't ring a bell at all. So I'm into it.
Nice. Cool. So that was Deadline. I need to see that. I binged the shit out of Mick Garris's The Stand over two nights.
Oh, cool.
The Blu-ray that had just recently come out and had been remastered looks absolutely beautiful. So let's just get that out of the way. It is everything pales in comparison in terms of my old VHS and the DVDs and so on. So whoever was responsible for overseeing the remastering of this is to be commended. And I know Mick was involved in some way too.
Mick was surprised because he shot it in 16mm, but he said that like when he found out there was a blue, he said, well, you can never do it in high def because they converted all the 16mm to TV standards.
Right.
And so the fact that they went back, even he was surprised that they were able to do that.
Got it. Well,
I can't wait to get a look at it.
It looks really great. I would say that some of the scenes that require VFX or plate shots or whatever, they're a little raw. I mean, it feels like it dips back into VHS quality just a smidge. That's just a very small, very small moment of like, oh, that looks a little raw. But the funny thing is like revisiting The Stand, I had literally not seen this since the 90s. So, and then I was showing my wife for the first time, and she was so engaged with it that she wanted to probably binge it all in one night. But I remember when The Stand came out, it was an event. It was event television because it was like in the wake of the It and all that kind of stuff. And I even remember my local radio station playing Don't Fear the Reaper by Blue Oyster Cult, but they played it on the classic rock station, but they played the clip version, like so you heard like the wind blowing through the army base and the crow cawing, and they were like, remember at the end of hearing the song, they were like, and that was from The Stand, and I was like, yeah, that's cool. But The Stand is really interesting because in 2020 it still makes for great television. It's a great kind of very epic story to tell, but I don't know if it's just my 2020 cynicism or maybe it just never worked at all, because I remember reading this Stand when I was in like early high school, but that ending is almost unforgivable.
Oh yeah.
Because you build so much goodwill in this good versus evil battle. And if you've never read The Stand or seen The Stand, it's basically about a plague wiping out everybody. And those who are immune get broken up into two factions. One faction goes to the good side with Mother Abigail, and then the bad side go to the man in black, Randall Flagg. And Flagg gathers everybody up in Vegas because it's the city of sin. And Abigail, Mother Abigail and her flock basically take root in a small town and start to rebuild society. But they know that Randall Flagg and his people are up to no good. So they send a couple of people to go see what Flagg is up to, and shenanigans ensue. But, you know, the first episode of the actual plague itself and the spread of Captain Trips is so masterfully done, bouncing between character setup and then Ed Harris, who is representing the government and watching this from the safety of his government base, and watching, like, it's like literally looking at fucking the charts that we see on CNN today, where it's just America with these red blips all over how the virus is spreading. And, you know, and just, you know, listening to Ed Harris talking about trying to control things. Now, thankfully, in this country today, we are not seeing a clampdown of military shooting radio DJs like they do in this movie, because they're talking the truth about what's happening with the virus. But it is so relevant today. Mm-hmm. It's chilling. And then, you know, once it starts to ease into the story and you're seeing the separation of good and evil happen, it's very engaging. The characters are great. All the characters are great. The casting is a little, you know, it feels a little television. Gary Sinise, it's got Gary Sinise and Molly Ringwald. But I'm happy to say that The Stand is incredibly enjoyable. You just have to forgive the finale. And that's not through Mick's fault. Mick, it's not your fault. As pure Stephen King, and your faithfulness, and the fact that Stephen King wrote the script for this. So, but what it made me very curious about is now Josh Boone, like Josh Boone and CBS All Access and their adaptation. I was finding myself after watching each episode and looking up IMDb and seeing who got cast as who.
Doing it right now. I was just curious. Yeah, about that.
It's amazing. It's amazing who he got. Like, he's got James Marsden and Amber Heard and Marilyn Manson and Whoopi Goldberg playing Mother Abigail. I mean, like,
who's Amber Heard? Is she Nadine?
Yeah, she's Nadine.
Ooh, that was always that was my favorite character in the original.
So crazy, crazy. And then Skarsgård, Alexander Skarsgård from, or is it Alexander Skarsgård from True Blood?
Yeah,
who's
yeah.
the hunky dude for True Blood?
Yes,
yeah. So he's playing Randall Flagg.
That makes sense.
Which is like that makes sense. Ooh. So I mean, like. It just goes to show that The Stand is one of those stories. I don't mind seeing a new adaptation of it. Mick did a great job. I mean, like, I got to commend Mick for watching it from a production standpoint, because this thing took place, like, they shot all over the fucking country.
Oh, yeah.
Like, they shut down streets. They shot in New York. I mean, like, it's amazing to me that in the early 90s, Mick and his crew were just able to take whatever city they wanted to go shoot in and bring this story to life and give it scope. And you know, he did a fantastic job of it. So The Stand is definitely poignant and relevant for our times and definitely worth revisiting.
Well, it's funny. I remember when they were shooting in New York, they didn't even shut much down because, like you said, they're shooting on 16. And it was almost like a guerrilla production. Like, they were shooting in Central Park. And they just had like a 16 camera on a tripod, and they were picking it up and putting it down and getting their shots.
That's amazing. Mike, were you, did you go to set? Were you on set?
Yeah, I got to go on set a couple of times. And you know, when they did the scene in Times Square in the video arcade, they didn't even shut it down. They just like brought the camera, had the actors, and they had all these like, you know, unpaid extras wandering around in the background.
That's amazing. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of people in this. I mean, like, there are a lot of cameos. It's like Sam Raimi, Joe Bob Briggs, playing Joe Bob, Tom Holland. You know, it just goes on and on. There's so many people in this fucking thing, but it is definitely, I mean, like, I don't know. I just say there was a fun time for television.
I remember
to see like so much Stephen King just coming out.
I remember watching this one with my parents, which we never did together. Like we would watch X-Files together as a family. And then I remember watching it with them and then this. And I was in high school at the time. So for me to like sit down with my parents and watch TV was kind of a lame thing. But I do remember this being like an event that I wasn't going to miss. And it was for me just as much as it was my parents. And so I have vivid memories of us being like, okay, we're going to watch it again tonight. Like it was the most planned thing I think we've ever done was watch The Stand.
I remember we got all the screeners at the Fango office at the same time. And brought all of them over to a friend's house on a Saturday. And we did the original binge watch. We watched the whole damn thing. On about how many? 8, 10, however many hours it was.
Like, yeah.
That was pretty great.
Oh, that's cool. That's cool. Yeah. I mean, it was fun because it kind of got me motivated to not just revisit it, but also revisit some of the lesser King adaptations like Tommyknockers. Oof. Now James Wan is producing a new Tommyknockers, and I'm just like, you know what? I remember being super excited for Tommyknockers and being so disappointed.
I watched Tommyknockers maybe 2 years ago because I wanted to revisit it. And I do have to say, there are some creepy moments in it. For the most part, it didn't work for me, but there are definitely some creepy moments with it, with the chanting. There's some stuff with the lipstick tube, the kid doing magic shows that somehow...
Tracy Lords.
Yeah, Tracy Lords is in it. It's somehow creepier on the rewatch. And I have to say, as I've gotten older, I thought Rose Red was like garbage when it came out, but I rewatched that a couple of years ago as well. And I really like it now. Like there's some good stuff in that.
Well, Rose Red, I thought was like a, was King's attempt to do like The Haunting.
It felt like The Haunting mixed with like the Winchester Mystery House. And so it wasn't true King. And I remember when it came out being like, I don't know what this is, but it just doesn't work for me. And now I'm kind of like, I don't know, maybe I'm old, but I like it now. Like there's something very subtle about it that I find kind of more alluring than I did when I was younger.
Nice. Well, before we move on and toss to you, Becca, I do got to give a shout out to Diabolik DVD for having The Stand on Blu-ray, because apparently in addition to everybody buying toilet paper and paper towels and tissues and all things at the grocery store and all exercise equipment on Amazon, I could not fucking buy The Stand on Amazon because I had to go to a third party to buy it.
Was it price gouged?
And they price gouge. Yeah, I was like, fuck that. I'm just going to go to Diabolik. So thank you, Jesse.
Well, I actually have been taking this time to watch digital screeners because there's so much stuff coming out on VOD. And especially now, of course, there's like two or three of them every week. And I actually saw a film that it's new, but obviously made before current events, but it's very timely. It's an Irish film called Sea Fever.
Oh, good. I loved it.
Yeah.
I want to see it.
For those who don't know, it's about a Hermione Corfeld, who is in a really good movie called Rust Creek last year, plays this kind of socially awkward marine biology student who goes on a research trip on this Irish fishing trawler full of salty old sea types. The captain is Dougray Scott. His wife is Connie Nielsen. And along the way, they get kind of waylaid by some kind of strange creature that introduces an infection into the crew. And it becomes all about, like, who's infected? What are we going to do about the people that are infected? We have to separate ourselves from them. We have to figure out what's going on. It's really well done, and it's so topical, kind of accidentally, what's going on right now. It's really good. It comes out on VOD next Tuesday, I think, so seek that one out.
I love.
I think they're doing. Yeah. I was gonna say. I think they're doing a. Today is the 8th when we're recording this, and the 10th is when this drops. I think by the time you can listen to this, it's going to be on iTunes. I know that they're doing some sort of quote unquote premiere, like early premiere of it,
with the director and Hermione Corfeld and Connie Nielsen doing a Q&A. I maybe after or before this airs, but
right on.
But check it out for sure. It's It's funny because I actually saw two Irish genre films by women directors in 2 days. The other one is a film that's out now called The Other Lamb, which
that's my next one too. But I think the director is Polish.
Yeah, I'm not going to try to say her name from memory because she has a very long Polish name. But
Sumoska is the last name. Sumoska. Yeah,
yeah, it's like it's that. Not really a horror film. It kind of has horror imagery, yeah. But it's about
it's like an A24 horror film.
It's not even as horrific as that. It's mostly a drama. It has like some visions that this girl has, but it's basically this guy is the sort of messianic leader of this all women cult, and half the women are his wives and half are his daughters. And it's all about this one girl who starts questioning what's going on, and things get bad from there. Again, mostly a drama, but very intense. And again, they're both Irish, both very, they have this kind of European sensibility, both by women directors. So both definitely worth checking out.
Yeah, that one has Michael, is it Huseman, playing the cult leader? From The Invitation. And he's also the novelist in Haunting of Hill House, the series.
Oh, yeah.
And he's really, it's really good. I thought it's really compelling. It's one of those films that unfortunately has that rhythm where it's just the one note. There's really not much of a change up throughout. And so it looks gorgeous, but it never really takes it to another level. But the actress, the lead, Rafe Cassidy, she's from Killing of a Sacred Deer. She's the girl.
Okay. And I was wondering where I'd seen her before. Right.
Yeah. And she's really good. And this has some similarities to Killing of a Sacred, just little moments that maybe kind of think of that film. But there is some great imagery. I liked a lot about it. I thought once it starts going, here's a cult leader with all these wives who are now aging out of his interest and his daughters are aging into his interest. That's where there's this very disturbing line that they don't really go into too much, but it's kind of the tension of the film. There's some imagery with like early on, like some drowning, like people underwater imagery that I thought was quite evocative. I saw that one as well. And with Sea Fever, we were just saying that would make a great double this year with Underwater underwater is the deep sea. And this is above sea, like it's all above water.
Yeah,
I think the two pair, you know.
Sea Fever for me was like Leviathan, but if the ship was a ship and not a submarine, where it is just this like spreading infection and trying to figure out how to do it. And it had my favorite jump scare of the year so far, where they know he's infected, but they don't know to what end yet. And then something happens and you're like, oh my God, like it's nuts.
Yeah, I jumped.
So did we. We saw it.
I jumped on my couch and I jumped.
Yeah, we saw it at Panic Fest a couple of months ago, and it just blew me away. It was just my perfect mix of aquatic horror and gore and me going, ooh, what's this new creature type stuff? Like, it was great.
Oh, I can't wait. Yeah.
The thing in there, like when they find the other ship and go aboard, but it's really its own film. So I'm looking forward to what this director comes up with next.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's cool. Yeah. That's super cool. All right, Becca.
Yeah, so I watched, like Mike, I've been kind of going through a lot of my digital screeners that I hadn't gotten a chance to circle back to yet. So last night I watched The Wretched. This one.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, this is due out from IFC Midnight May 1st. So next,
Pierce Brothers.
Yeah, the Pierce Brothers did this. I loved their prior work, Deadheads, was kind of a horror comedy, which I totally dug. This is vastly different. It does not have a comedic bone in the entire movie. It's very serious from start to finish. And it is about a young boy who's kind of this rebellious kid, and he is forced to go spend a summer with his dad working at this like boat resort place on a lake. It's like a lakefront community. And while he's there, something weird starts happening with the family next door. It's like a very platonic family next door with a mom, a dad, and two kids. And all of a sudden, some weird shit starts happening with the mom. And he starts getting really suspicious that something's going on. She's possessed. There's all these weird, like, cult-like symbols that he starts seeing around in the woods and stuff like that. And really quickly, you realize that the mom has been possessed by a witch. And that's where I'll stop. But there were parts of this that I absolutely loved. The effects were amazing. Like the monster effects, the creature effects, everything that they were doing were great. I loved the approach to the witch, because the witch approach in this, it's not traditional witch, like cackling hag on broom. It's much more like the comic Witches with a Y, where it's
I've got that one.
Yeah, it's functions much more like that, where it's kind of this ancient creature connected with trees, and it has some supernatural capabilities, but it's much more of kind of this primordial creature than it is like, my name's Matilda and I died in the 1600s. It's nothing like that.
Wait, did you just say The Guardian? We all love The Guardian. You said Tree Witch, Tree Babysitter.
Tree Babysitter. No, this is much more of like this uncontrollable creature of rage who's connected with trees, and that there's magic involved, but it's much more of like this primordial creature. And I love that approach. Where I bumped with the movie is that the main character, the boy, I was not interested in him. Like, I would have rather see like one of the Plutonic members of the family as kind of the protagonist, like the husband or anything like that. But putting it in this teenage son living next door felt very removed from what I was interested in. And we were watching him go through his little teenage love affair and stuff like that. So that was kind of my thing. There was not much tension because of that. It was like Fright Night if Charlie was just generally a not interesting character. So, and it's not funny in any capacity, but it does have kind of these Fright Night It Kids on Bikes feel to it, but it's very... very flat through the whole thing emotionally. Okay. So, but the great effects and the witch is really cool.
You know, I got to talk to the Pierces at Fantasia last year, and they said the witch is based a lot on Irish folklore. And they mentioned some of the legends that they use. I can't remember them offhand. You can read all about it in the next issue of Fango. Plug, plug. They took a lot from Irish folklore when they were coming up with the witch and, you know, her forest home and what she does and everything.
That totally makes sense.
I love how much of a hotspot Ireland has been this last decade. Mm-hmm. It's really amazing. It's really like every year there's something interesting coming out of Ireland horror-wise, which is pretty amazing for the UK, I think.
Sea Fever is, I should put in a plug, it was produced by a company, I think it's just called Fantastic Films, and it's two guys, Brendan McCarthy and John McDonnell, I think, and they've just produced a consistent series of great horror films out of Ireland. Let Us Pray was one. I think that
one
of the years. I like that one.
Yeah. They've just had a great string of great Irish horror films, and this is another one, Sea Fever.
Nice.
Yeah.
Very, very cool.
Elric, what do you
got? I got a couple more I can throw in there. So yeah, I saw The Other Lamb last night, actually. I saw the first episode of Cursed Films, the new Shudder series that is, what, a 6-part series? Each one is on a different film. I would say if it had been 15 minutes shorter, I would have been a little happier. I thought The Exorcist, I thought the detail was great. I think what was really good about the series, actually, which I wasn't expecting because I thought it was going to be more sensational, is that the experts it chose was not just us. I know you might appear at some point, one of you might appear, but it wasn't just horror fans. It was Phil's in there, Phil Noble, but it was mostly people from, you know, somebody who's a journalist from a newspaper, somebody who's an actual doctor from the movie, an actual priest. And I found that was just far more compelling because it felt like a documentary, not just an entertainment documentary, felt like an actual kind of just narrative documentary. But and this one's about cursed movies that, and obviously that's, you know, you're going to instantly bump to that if you don't believe in this stuff. I, you know, obviously going to approach this stuff completely as a skeptic, though the stories around these movies have always been pretty remarkable. And I remember being about 19 when I read a really in-depth piece. I can't remember if it was like the UK movie magazine Empire or something, but it was about, you know, how the set burned down and all these just different stories. It can be whatever you want that to be, but you know, this one, it gets weird because like halfway through they just bring in this exorcist in
quote, Bauhaus, Mr. Bauhaus.
Yeah, he's not a priest, he's not, and it felt like padding, especially if you don't have, say, Friedkin as part of something. You can't ever fault anyone for not being able to land these big people, but to replace that kind of a voice with something that just really didn't need to be in there, to me, it I hope the future ones don't need to resort to that, because it really was compelling. I found it to be, had it been 20 minutes, it would have been just top-notch entertainment, infotainment, as it were. But I did like it, and there was a couple bits. It was fun to see Eileen Dietz in the conversation for a change, because she's always been cut out of talking about these things in a way. I mean, she's always wanted to talk, right? But the way they have her and Linda Blair actually, you know, almost side by side, the way they cut it is kind of refreshing for a change, because those stories don't get told that often together. But yeah, I liked it, and I'm definitely in to watch all of these. But yeah, I do have a skepticism about, obviously, you know, most of us do if we're into horror, about, you know, whether a curse of, obviously, I'm probably most nervous when they get to something like Twilight Zone about that. That makes me nervous.
So full disclosure, they came in to interview me at the Blumhouse office in our little theater for about an hour or so. And I am by no means an expert on these kinds of things, but I'm, you know, well-versed in terms of hearing about what had happened. And obviously, you know, Rob, you and I are friends with Dave Scow, so we have a little bit more knowledge about The Crow. But I approached it with a level of heavy skepticism. So I don't know, like, going forward. I mean, I'm not in the Exorcist episode at all, but I'm very curious to see how I'm portrayed in the other episodes.
Too, right?
Yeah.
Where you're edited in, yeah.
Yeah, so I'm very curious to see if my level of kind of, well, I think a little bit's bullshit and a lot of it, you know, imagine what it would be like in the internet generation today, kind of thing. But I thought the first episode was very good. I'm very curious to see where the rest go.
And they didn't. I don't think they're doing Three Men and a Little Baby, which is a shame because I want to see that Ted Danson ghost in the back. It's like, who doesn't want to hear that story? You know, it's a ghost. Yeah, I don't believe in much, but I believe in that.
In New Zealand, they will all. Oh, yeah. Believe it was a ghost.
We all believe that. No, but I will say, like, there's a part of me at this age that is hesitant about a series like this and skeptical, and we all kind of texted each other when we first heard about it. But I then remember what I was like as a 19-year-old, and I had to find these little factoids online, and they lit my fucking brain on fire. And I was so excited to learn things, even if it was total horseshit, right, about these, this movie was cursed, or this Ted Danson thing. That was exciting at a certain age to discover. So I think maybe there's, you know, hopefully some maybe younger audiences, this will be all new to them. For us, we've heard most of these stories. Yeah. So I'm curious. I'm going to hold off judgment, but I will say they were very well made, and the experts used were very good. And I just want to throw one other movie that I really liked. I'm curious if anyone's seen this one. It was on Fandor, which I'm just a huge Fandor fan. I've been talking about Fandor for years on here. I buy stocks in Fandor. Becca's been telling us to watch Fangor for a while. Fandor. Anyway, I did it for her because she wanted me to talk about it in the Fourth of Flesh. And I did that. And that movie's good, but I won't talk about that here. I stumbled upon a film by the guy who did Inseminoid and Bloody New Year, Norman J. Warren, called Prey, P-R-E-Y. And it was also called Alien Prey. And you know what?
Vinegar
Syndrome. Yeah. This is.
I never put it out. Yeah.
It's only like 75 minutes. It's like a little gem of a movie. It's really. Oh. It's okay. So here's the part that like blew me away. It's 1977. It opens with a lesbian couple who live in the countryside in a giant mansion in the most normal portrayal of a lesbian couple in the history of movies, let alone 1977. My brain, I couldn't even believe what I was watching because they were just like, oh yeah, I love you. Just totally nice, normal couple. There's nothing sensationalized. There was nothing just nudie to titillate an audience. I couldn't even believe it. I was like, wait a minute, this doesn't happen in movies. Even now, it hardly happens in movies. And it was really cool. And they were the leads. And then in the opening scene, one of them's looking out a window and sees some lights. And then you realize it's kind of extra-ish. Some sort of alien creature has landed. And it looks like the man who fell to Earth. That's what he looks like. Except he then suddenly will have these fangs and his eyes will bulge when he has his predatorial, like he sees food. And so he'll hunt some animals and he looks kind of like vampiric and it's kind of cool. And then eventually he kind of comes to the house and they're kind of, one of them's a little bit more into the idea of being bi and swinging and bringing him into the fold than the other one.
Wait, they have sex with the alien?
No, not straight away. It's like it's hinted at, but they bring him in and they like have a dinner with him.
Ease him into the alien sex.
Yeah. I told you, it's totally realistic. it goes all Harold Pinter a bit with the guest showing up. But it's really, he kind of, you know, gets in there, and then there's a couple really fucked up scenes. It's insinuated maybe there was a man on the scene in the past who maybe got disposed of before this part of the story you're watching. And then this guy, when he gets in there, you start to realize, oh, he's kind of studying humans, kind of in the same way in a less classy version, like Bad Taste, they're studying humans. But in this, it's like it's more hinted at what humans could mean to aliens. And there's a couple parts that are really bloody and strange. And it's just, it's quite a classy, weird indie affair. It feels very low budget. I think it might have been like $100,000 film back then. But I was really impressed. I think it would make a great double feature with Man Who Fell to Earth because they're totally different movies, but both British, you know. But this one was a really nice surprise. So, you know, give it a whirl. It wouldn't say much more. There isn't a lot of story. So,
well, do you want to know a really great bit of trivia about that movie?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
You know, there's a little girl who shows up towards the end?
Yes.
Okay.
At the very end, yeah.
That is Kelly Marcel, the daughter of the producer, Terry Marcel. That little girl grew up to be the scriptwriter of 50 Shades of Grey, Venom, and Baz Luhrmann's upcoming Elvis movie.
What?
When you say Venom, not the British Venom, though, right?
No, the you know, the superhero one.
Wow. Tom Hardy. That's right. Well, clearly, you know what show we're on.
Yeah.
You mean the classic the Oliver Reed movie?
No. Holy crap.
That's actually, Oliver Reed would have been a great Venom. Holy shit. Oh, my God. That's the greatest casting ever.
The symbiote has got nothing on Oliver Reed. He would drink the symbiote.
He probably would.
Wow.
All right. That was Prey. Rob, what do you got?
I'm going to do two more quick fire Blu-rays. Here's another one from Vinegar Syndrome. They put this out last year, and it's called The Corruption of Chris Miller.
Mm-hmm. Ooh, oh, which, tell me. Right, yeah. I have that. Tell me.
Yeah, I'd never really heard of this. So this is from 1973, and it is a Spanish, it's in English, but it was Spanish made, and it's claimed to be kind of like a long lost early 70s, like giallo.
Okay.
And it's basically, it's about this young girl named Chris Miller. Well, it opens with a random murder, with a guy wearing a really creepy mask. And you're like, oh, okay. That's kind of, all right. We'll see what this is. And then we're with this girl named Chris Miller and her stepmom who have kind of like this secluded and weird relationship. And, Chris is kind of like a little, she's been traumatized by her father's death and a very young stranger comes to town. He's basically like sleeping in the barn naked. And he's like this good looking guy that starts flirting with both of them. So basically the movie is that for like an hour. You're like, what the hell am I watching here? And then randomly about an hour into the movie, there is a hooded, like he looks like he's in a rain slicker. There's literally out of nowhere. Yeah, an hour into the movie, there is I don't even want to call it a massacre, but this hooded guy shows up into the town, goes into a house, and basically kills the entire family in the house. And you're like, whoa, okay, well, here's the giallo part, I guess. And so then you're led to believe, like, all right, so is the stranger, is the young kid that came to town, is that him? Is it not? It's like they kind of leave it as a mystery. And then the ending is kind of so bonkers the way that they wrap it all together that it kind of lost me. So this is kind of like a lot of giallos where the whole 90 minutes, it's 113 minutes. So it's almost 2 hours long. It's kind of brutal, but it's kind of awesome for that one scene. So it's like, okay, it's like a traditional giallo where you're like, oh, it has that one great scene where the rest of it's kind of a little meandering. So it's kind of like a cautious recommendation. If you want to see something a little bit different and that has a couple of sequences that are interesting, then this is pretty cool. But like most giallos, I don't remember a lot of it other than that standout sequence in the middle with the rain slicker guy. And the ending, I don't want to
call Tongue of Fire or something. Lizard with a tongue.
Iguana.
That's the same thing. The opening scene of that was like, oh, that's the best thing. And then the rest of the movie was like, to me, a flat line. I remember the opening. Yes.
Yeah. No, the opening of that one.
So this is interesting. And I'm going to tie it into another one that's similar. I also picked up from Ronin Flicks, aka Scorpion. They did Argento's Sleepless, which I'm not as well versed in the latter Argento movies. Like, I vaguely remember seeing them when they came out and nothing else of it.
Yeah.
It's kind of funny because these all get a bad rap. I just picked up this and what were the other two they put out? Phantom of the Opera,
the card player,
which I actually kind of liked in retrospect. Yeah. It's definitely of its time. This is the same deal. It's not as colorful and as daring as the way Argento kind of directed in his earlier career. But when you look at it in the context of what he does, it's not that far different. I mean, it opens with a crazy murder that a young boy sees. The young boy grows up. They never catch the murderer. And Max von Sydow is the detective who always vowed to catch him. And then this killer reemerges. And so now the little boy all grown up teams up with Max von Sydow to try to track this guy down. And, you know, there's a couple, I mean, the acting and some of the characters are pretty funny.
But That's got a sequence as good as most of his best sequences on the train. I think one of the first victims on the train is up there with Pure Argento.
The train scene is great.
Yeah, that's the thing. Yeah.
My big problem is that...
Yeah, there's a great train scene.
I knew who the killer was the moment a certain scene happened. And that hasn't happened with me in an Argento film before. There's that one scene, I think you know which one I mean, and I'm like, uh-huh, that's him.
So, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the reveal isn't great. Let's just say that. But at the same time, it was so left out of left field that it's like what I expect from an Argento movie is like, of course it's going to be that person that I sort of suspected, but never like, well, I don't know how that works, but okay, sure, I'll buy it. So it's not bad. It's not great, but I'm enjoying kind of delving into the 90s/2000 era Argento, which I'm glad is getting re-released now. So that's Sleepless on Blu-ray now.
Yeah, I like that one. I mean, of his latter work, you know,
excellent.
Post-opera, I think that's a pretty interesting movie.
I haven't seen that one yet, but I enjoyed The Card Player. I know I'm by myself in that, but I didn't think it was bad. I thought it had some flaws, but it was it was okay.
Yeah, I remember seeing The Card Player and liking it, but I've not seen it since.
Yeah, me neither.
So maybe that says something. Gingle, what do you got? Anything else?
That's what I got so far, really. I'm going to not say anything about Card Player.
I got two more that I will go through real quick, just because one I talked with you guys about earlier this week, and that is The Unholy, which for some reason stumbled across my path this week, and then I was suddenly like, I'm going to order it. So I ordered the Vestron Blu-ray off of Amazon and got it a couple of days ago. And I had vague recollections of this movie. Like there's some type of like naked redhead. And I remembered like a big creature at the end and like ghoulies show up. But I didn't have much past that. And then I discovered that is it. There's a scantily clad redhead through the whole thing. At the end, this like creature comes out and some little ghoulie things show up. And that's about
what more do you need?
So
that's a movie right there.
Yeah, no, there's a very loose plot, which if you poke it too much, kind of falls apart. Where this priest has been chosen to open this parish, where all of these prior priests have been killed, like every year for the past couple of
seduced
and died. And what they discover is that this parish is being targeted by this particular demon, who shows up, seduces the priests. If they like give in to her and go for it, then she kills them. And this keeps happening, but now they've brought in this one priest, which is where I get that the plot gets paper thin. When he first arrives there, he goes to his superior priest dude and is like, hey guys, there's something weird and supernatural going on at this church. And they're like, we're going to have you committed. You're insane. Go back. You're just terribly wrong. And then literally two scenes later, they go, okay, now we can tell you the truth. It was just very kind of, okay, and now it is supernatural. And they knew everything all along. I don't know why they couldn't tell him a day prior, but whatevs. This does have really cool effects though. It moves along pretty slow. Like the dialogue scenes are slow. It does have a cool satanic club that I would have definitely hung out at, which is kind of like a grand gignolish place where they watch these like sacrifices and cool things being done on stage. And so that becomes kind of our opposition, is like the satanic club owner versus the priest. And then the young girl who's been seduced by the satanic club owner, but she wants to be at the church, but she's in love with the priest and drama. And but at the end, there's a really cool dog thingy that shows up. So kind of Zoolish, but even better. And I was talking online with Garrow, who was part of getting this one released and restoring it. Apparently,
not surprised.
Yeah, I have a feeling he was like pushing for this one. But yeah, at the end, apparently the version that was released back in 1980 was cut. They had cut the end creature down a little bit and it's in its full glory. Like, I don't remember. It has pendulous boobs, whereas as a redhead, it's absolutely breathtaking. But when it goes to like the haggy dog thing, it's got these pendulous boobs hanging down that you now see swinging as it walks.
So, can you say pendulous boobs?
Pendulous boobs.
So amazing.
But you should have seen her as a redhead. Yeah. I remember this movie and the unnameable, that's the very Lovecraftian creature, right? I remember seeing them at the same time when I was young and loving both of them so much that I was worried to rewatch either of them. And when I rewatched Unnameable, you know, the creature still held up. The movie was pretty clunky. And then this one I haven't gone back to. And all of you shaking your head about it make me think I should not
rewatch. It's kind of fun. Yeah. It's got, I did like it. Got a few moments. Before we move on, I will quickly give a plug. So I got the kids a Nintendo Switch because we've been trapped inside the house and they really wanted to play Animal Crossing with Elric's kids. So now we can. So
that's the plan.
That's the plan. We're playing Animal Crossing. It's going to be amazing. But I was like, I'm going to download me a game. So I started Googling like what's the best horror games on Nintendo Switch. And what I encountered was one that I've had a lot of fun with for the past couple of days, which is this game called Hello Neighbor.
Yes.
And did you play it, Ryan?
Oh my God. Fucking Hello Neighbor destroyed.
I've only had it for 2 days and I'm so into this now. The concept is, I know Peterson, right? But the concept is that, you know, your neighbor has done some shady shit. You hear these screams coming from his basement and he's acting all suspicious and you are trying to break into his house to get into his basement to see what he's done. And it goes further, like even just in 2 days of obsessive gameplay, I'm a little bit past that, but that's kind of the intro. And so the game learns as you go along. So like if you sneak in a window, the next time that you try to sneak in the window, there'll be a bear trap there. And it's completely mind boggling. And
I mean, I don't know who's beating it, but it is the most impossible video game to beat.
But at the same time, I'm addicted to it right now. Where even like I was teaching today and the whole time I'm like, oh wait, I didn't try that drain pipe yesterday. And so it's like processing in my brain. It's literally like the Burbs. If you were trying to break into the Klopex house, but the Klopex were fighting back. And I have a feeling that there was
actually, that's Animal Crossing as well. That's all they're doing. It's the Burbs.
I want to know why my kid comes downstairs and tells me how much she owes a fucking raccoon right now. Every morning she's like, well, I owe this raccoon this much. I'm like, why are you in debt to a raccoon? Do I need to knock this guy out or what?
I got the kids Animal Crossing because our babysitter came over one night and she was like, I gotta show Marnie Animal Crossing. So I brought my Switch along because I have a flamingo who loves horror films and it reminds me of you, Becca. And I was like, wait, what? And so I had to try it. And then Elric had been telling me about how obsessed his kids are with it. So
that's all they're doing so far. And the students I teach who are 20-year-olds, that's all they're doing.
Oh yeah, so dude.
Talking to them and my kid's coming in who's 5 and I was like, wow. And they're like, he should really farm tarantulas. Tell him that's the best way to make money. And I'm like telling him and he's like, oh, okay, that's good. And I'm like, I have no idea what any of you talk about.
Okay, tonight I'm going to give up on Hello Neighbor for a little bit just so I can play. I haven't tried Animal Crossing yet, so I'm going to give it a shot.
Okay.
But Hello Neighbor is great.
Hello Neighbor. Yeah, that's a tough one. I've got two more things I want to talk about. One is I revisited Your Next since the first time since the year it came out. Holds up great. Yeah. That movie is super intense. Sharni Vincent is a final girl for the ages. There's some great intensity to it. It's pretty relentless. I'm very, very happy that I gave it another look. And then the other one I watched is this film called Freaks, which stars Emile Hirsch.
Oh, that movie's amazing.
Bruce Dern, right? Sci-fi film?
Bruce Dern, a little bit of a sci-fi thriller where Emile Hirsch plays this dad who keeps his kid under lock and key in this home, a very disheveled, terrible, like broken down home. But the belief system they want you to go into is he's got his daughter locked up because what's outside in the real world is scary and he's protecting her from something. But what you discover, and this isn't a spoiler because there's so many layers to it, what you discover is they are the other. They are the abnormal. They are the other thing. They're the thing that the outside world wants to get rid of. And it's kind of like a low budget X-Men movie.
I thought these guys are going to get snapped up by Marvel and the two directors.
I know. And the funny thing is when I looked him up, it's directed by Zach Lipofsky and Adam Stein. Lipofsky directed Leprechaun Origins. Mm-hmm.
Hmm. Yeah.
That was the movie he did before this. So there was a definite level up for Zach as a filmmaker. But in terms of just I will express a little bit of frustration because I think it tries to be so coy about showing its hand, like it almost to a fault where it's like it's withholding information, withholding to a point where you're 40 minutes in, you're like, guys, you got to give us some reward here. And then finally, about an hour in, they do. And the rewards are very, very pleasing. I mean, like I it's on Netflix now, and it was something that I had flagged because it played at one of the festivals. And I was very happy with it. It was very well done, but not strictly horror in a sense, but definitely got a thriller elements to it. And, like I said, if you go in thinking, yeah, really great layers.
I think her name's Ava Kolker is amazing too.
Yeah.
She gives one of the best child performances I've seen in a long time.
So good. So good. Yeah. No, she's very good, but very good little movie.
I've heard enough sci-fi nerddom from both you and Beckett today that I feel like this summer we should do an only sci-fi episode of our favorite sci-fi, not even sci-fi horror, just sci-fi, because we have not really done that on Shockwaves. I think we owe
it. That's true. Okay.
Owe it to your nerddom. Oh,
just sci-fi, just straight sci-fi. It can be anything.
Sierra's got to come on for this so that I have a Trek nerd.
I know. Yeah, yeah. The funny thing you say that is, we are two episodes away from the finale of Picard.
Nice.
And every time I'm like, hey, honey, let's watch the last two episodes of Picard. She's like, I'm not ready yet. I'm not ready. I'm like, what do you mean you're not ready yet? Just sit down and watch it. She's like, no, I feel like I'm going to be too worked up or I'm too tired.
There's also
bright moments.
There's a sadness thing too, because I binged all of it and then I was sad. It's like when you're drinking a really good milkshake and you get to the end and you're sad that there's no more milkshake left.
Okay, I get that.
Wait, is it over? Was it a one and done show?
No, they're already gone. They got season two coming.
I don't have any more Star Trek for a while, and that's heartbreaking. So,
tonight, and I was going to talk about it on the show. I was going to watch it earlier, but I realized, Elric, I think you said you had revisited, but I'm going to rewatch the original Ring tonight.
It was Lee. Lee was the
one. Oh, Lee, that's right. That's right. I literally have not seen the original Ring in a decade.
Is this probably on the fancy new box set?
No, the Arrow had sent me just the single. Oh, the single.
If you Blu-ray. Get, yeah, if yeah. For those of you with the fancy new box set, you can watch me as a talking head through all of the films, talking about them.
Nice.
Before we jump into talking about our favorite marketing moments and Mike's book, let's really quickly look at our Night Flight pick of the week. So this week, guys, we picked one of my favorites, but I know Elric's a big fan as well, and I'm anxious to hear from you guys too.
Bring on the shunting.
And that is Society is currently streaming on Night Flight and is therefore our Night Flight pick of the week. Okay, guys.
Yes.
So Elric and I last year were invited during Phoenix Fan Fusion, which has regrettably been unfortunately been postponed to September because of the outbreak. But we were asked to screen something at the Fantastic Film Bar while we were down there last year. And we picked Society. And it was amazing.
They hadn't seen it.
No one had seen it.
Almost no one. Monty Yazzie, who hooked us up and got us there, had seen it. But a lot of them hadn't seen it. I remember as soon as it ended, we heard some really nervous, strange laughter. It was pretty great. I remember when it ended, we stood up in front of them silently, and I just started undoing my belt.
He took his belt off and said,
I just started taking my pants off. And the reaction, there's a couple faces that looked truly worried.
It was wild.
It was a great screen.
But it was so much fun to screen that with a group of people. I think out of the audience, probably a little over 50, only one had seen it before.
Yeah,
it was such a big deal when it came out.
Right?
Yeah.
And so Society, I loved this film. I never understood it until I got older. This is one of those that I watched when I was really young, and I understood that there was like – you know, that they were wealthy and there was something about aliens and then they turned into this thing at the end. But I never really understood all the sexual connotations of it until I got older. But it's stuck with me, of course.
Yeah, it's one of those movies that I for some strange reason, I didn't see until college. And what a revelation it is, because, you know, it's talking about the one percenters and the and dealing with all sorts of weird sexual taboos, and lots of great goopy effects from Screaming Mad George. Mm-hmm. When we initially, and I've said this elsewhere, when we acquired Get Out as a script, Jordan came into my office. You know, he was looking at all the cool, like, horror nerd shit I had, and we were kind of talking a little bit about the script, and I said, you know, Jordan, thematically what you're delving into, you know, I see some parallels to Society. And he was like, what's Society? And I was like, let me tell you about Society.
Wait, you didn't just start singing the song?
No.
You should have just started singing.
Oh, hail Society.
When I pitched it to him, he was like, yeah, I need to see this movie right away. And and I'd like to think that Jordan went home that night and watched Society.
That's hilarious. What it is, the reason we socially distance now is this film. So keep that in mind. You watch what happens at the end, and you don't want to go near another human, so you're good. No, I mean, this the ending of this is about the biggest showstopper I could. It's one of the few films that, you know, couldn't disappoint, at least on that level.
Yeah.
Like, there's a lot about the clunkiness of the high school drama performance, which is like a bad version of a Better Off Dead, but not mm-hmm. a good Better Off Dead. And then it, you know, some of the casting is a little wonky, but like Brian Yuzna's the first person to cop to that. I remember when I interviewed him for that, the one time that thing in Fango was, he's just like, yeah, it's not very good with actors and directing, but I really like surrealism and special effects. And I was like, that's why your films are really good. You know, they're really fun. And this movie is an utter blast, but definitely probably would be a good one to, you know, get all your friends on the, on their Zoom while you watch this one.
Oh, yeah.
So get some react.
No, this
yeah,
is-
get as many people as possible who have never seen this film.
Yeah.
And then just do a reaction video, just like record their reaction as they watch it.
Excellent.
And then send it to us.
So true. Yeah. Yeah. Let us know what you guys think of Society. You can see Society right now on Night Flight Plus, which you can get to by visiting www.nightflightplus.com/shockwaves. Night Flight Plus is available on Roku, Apple TV, Amazon Fire, and online. This is the place to watch original episodes of the iconic 80s series Night Flight, which Ryan and I both grew up on. And you can also watch a lot of contemporary stuff, as well as an eclectic collection of like cult films, stuff from Arrow, Blue Underground, Severin. Subscriptions are just $4.99 a month and $39.99 a year. But for a limited time, Shockwaves listeners can save $10 off that annual membership with the promo code Shockwaves, one word, which knocks it down to less than $2.50 a month. So definitely check out nightflightplus.com/shockwaves.
And I got to say, Night Flight is, there's always something to discover there. Mm-hmm. I found they have these kind of like either summer horror movie specials or fall horror movie specials that they put up there. And there's like interviews with Robert Englund on a set of Nightmare on Elm Street 2. And the funny thing is I discovered they had, they must have been supplied with footage from Nightmare on Elm Street 2 that had not been run through the Freddy Krueger filter. So it's raw footage of Robert Englund's voice coming through the Freddy Krueger makeup. And it hadn't been thrown through the Freddy filter yet in the sound mix. So it's really fucking interesting. I mean, like, you'll never just, you know, it's so interesting to find, like, I'll be up late one night just kind of poking around and I'll find like a 1-900 ad for Ghostbusters. Like, call the Ghostbusters now and be an extra Ghostbuster. And it's like, what the fuck? Night Flight is a revelation. There's some really cool shit on there for the horror fan.
Do they have the episode? I remember they did one. The entire episode was the making of Big Trouble in Little China. And at,
you got to check.
They showed that music video. I've never seen it. And it's amazing.
My favorite Night Flight discovery so far was actually not on one of the horror episodes. I was watching a music one on DC Punk, just because I was so into DC Punk when I was in high school. And in the middle of it, they're interviewing a 19-year-old Steve Niles. about his band Grey Matter, and he's like put this baby face, and it was just like, holy shit, it's Steve.
That's amazing. I love it.
Yeah, I got to throw in one, since I haven't had a chance to talk about Night Flight in the last couple of weeks, this is the as nerdy as it gets. So we all know and love this cult movie called Bad Romance, right? That Warner Archive finally put out on Blu-ray. So I looked up Bad Ronald because the guy that plays Bad Ronald, he's kind of got like a Matthew Modine thing, but he didn't do a lot of movies. So I looked him up. His name is Scott Jacoby, and he's in a few other films, but not really. He directed one thing, and it was a documentary called Rage, 20 Years of Punk Rock West Coast Style. And this thing has been impossible to find. I'm scrolling through Night Flight, and Night Flight has fucking Rage, 20 Years of Punk Rock West Coast Style. So the punk documentary directed by Bad Ronald is on Night Flight.
I'm watching that one tomorrow. That's awesome.
That's so great.
I'm amazed there's not a punk band called Bad Ronald out there somewhere.
I know. It sounds like a good name.
There has to be. I'm sure someone will call us out about that.
Excellent, guys. Well, let's take a quick break, hear from our sponsors, and then let's come back and talk about our favorite moments in horror marketing.
Fright Rags has been giving you the best in horror apparel and accessories since 2003, offering hundreds of products for fan-favorite films. This week, they want you to obey and consume its They Live collection, featuring new shirts, classic reprints, and socks. Also this week, the triumphant return of the Tea of Mystery. You choose your size, and we will send you a random shirt shrouded in a black package so its contents are completely unknown to all who hold it. Only $9 and in limited supply, so grab yours while they last. Available exclusively at fright-rags.com. Shockwaves listeners get 10% off when they use the code SHOCKWAVES2020.
Tonight's episode of Shockwaves is brought to you by Fangoria.com. It's a little crazy out there right now, so Fangoria is offering a free 2-month digital membership to everyone. Go to Fangoria.com for more information and to make an account. Then pore over all the exclusive articles, interviews, and reviews on the site, as well as original video content and podcasts. You'll even have access to high-resolution scan of the first 15 original issues of the Fangoria magazine run, and counting. Go to Fangoria.com now and start your free digital membership. And if you're looking to add to your social distancing watch list, Fangoria's latest movie, VFW, is now available to stream on demand, and Satanic Panic is now streaming on Shudder.
All right, welcome back. As you've been hearing, we've got Mr. Mike Gingold on our show this week, and Mike has authored Ad Nauseam 2, and Ad Astra, which is a collection of newspaper ads from the 80s, 90s, and 2000s, both horror and sci-fi. Sci-fi being more focused in the Ad Astra book. Ad Nauseam is more our speed because it's a collection of all the great horror ads. And Mike, I got to tell you, where the fuck did you put all of these ads growing up? I mean, did you keep a file box or what?
Yeah, I pretty much kept like a large manila envelope for each year or so. I just cut them out, and you know, they don't take up a heck of a lot of space. So every time one would come up, I would just, I was so obsessive. I actually like wrote each title on the side of the envelope and everything, so I knew it was in there. They're all in there in chronological order. And I just amassed like whole piles of these very neatly organized envelopes full of ads. And eventually came a time where I thought I'd love to compile these somehow. And it took a long time before that actually happened.
Jesus Christ, you know, I still have my yearbooks, and yet
I know.
It's amazing. Well,
I got to tell you, we were talking about Deadline. Another thing is, for some reason, my high school growing up carried Variety. Got Variety in every week, and I would save all those incredible, I don't know if you guys ever saw these, but in the 80s they had these film festival issues tied to Cannes or MeFed or the AFM. They would literally be hundreds of pages long, and everybody selling some schlock film would take out like a full page ad for it. Canon Films always is at the front. They had about 60 pages of their own. And Deadline was an ad I saw in Variety years and years ago when it was at some festival, and I have still never seen it. So I'm looking forward to catching that Blu-ray.
Yeah. I saw it in one of those varieties. I saw it, and I think somebody was selling it recently. It's a one pager before they would go to Cannes with movies, and it was for Possession, and it was Chris Sarandon was going to be the lead. Really? So it said Chris Sarandon and Isabella Gianni, Possession. Yeah. And I was like, whoa. Like, I mean, thank God. Thank God we got Sam in there. But it is kind of amazing, those ads.
But I saved all those varieties, but those are really big and kind of bulky, and I eventually got rid of them, which I completely regret. But all of these ads, you know, even though there are a lot of them, they didn't take up too much room. So I was able to kind of hold on to them for all these years.
Yeah, and what's interesting, Mike, is at what stage, you know, in putting these books together, did the idea of collecting the review blurbs? Because, you know, you can look at, I'm like kind of sifting through the first Ad Nauseam, which is, and I just landed on the Night of the Creeps page, which is the full page ad for Night of the Creeps, and then it's accompanied by like a little sidebar with a collection of the reviews at the time. Where did that kind of idea come from?
Well, that was my other obsession, is collecting reviews as well. I would cut those out also. When I got to college at NYU, in the library there, they had this amazing resource called Newsbank, which was microfiche collections of, you had politics, you had sports, and you had movies, and it had movie reviews literally scanned out of the newspaper from like papers all over the country. So I spent countless hours down there copying these things and adding them to the file. And I figured I should really do something with this in addition to the ads, especially because I think it all started, the idea was hatched about, it's got to be going on 10 years ago. I hosted a screening of Friday the 13th. And I think everyone in the room, I think one of them had actually been born in 1980. And I was talking to them about how you go to Rotten Tomatoes now, I think Friday the 13th has about a 65. If you based it on the reviews at the time, it would have about a 20. You know, because a lot of these films did not get the respect that they have now from the critics at the time. And I thought it would be kind of interesting to go back and include some of the reviews from the period, find some ones that were positive, and then also the fun ones that were not. There's some really funny kind of pans of the movies in there as well. So, and it's just kind of a reflection.
Yeah, I think
this is not looking at them as like a contemporary reviewer watching them in a retrospective mode. This is what the actual critics at the time were saying. A lot of them were negative, but every so often you'd find some surprisingly positive ones. There's actually a very positive quote about Lucio Fulci's Zombie in there, for example, which you might not expect.
Bro, what was the, we had the producer of Street Trash on, and I don't know if this one appears in any of the books, but he told us that their marketing campaign at the time was they got these venomous, you know, reviews, but then they also had some positives. So they put the positive ones on one side of the picture and the negatives on the other, and the tagline became, "What side of the street are you on?" And I was like, that's just genius. Like, that's just such great marketing. You
There's
know?
Actually an ad, I think it's in the 90s book, Ad Nauseam 2, Lost Highway did the same thing.
Oh, perfect.
And there was also an ad that said, two thumbs down, Siskel and Ebert. Another good reason to go see. Right.
I think that was a Lynch one. I think that was a Lynch film.
Yeah,
because
he
obviously, he had his problems with Ebert.
Some of the independent distributors actually use the negative reviews to their advantage.
That's amazing. I was going to say, these are great. It's a great wealth of historical context, not only because of what you were talking about with the reviews, because I think it's especially important for horror fans today, of a younger generation, to see how these things were reviewed and to see that over time, horror films will find their audience. You know, I mean, you know, John Carpenter's The Thing or any of these films that were poorly reviewed in this book, you know, they all have their audience today. And not just that historical context, but also it's fun to see some of these ads lean into whatever was happening at the time. And I use Gremlins, for example, because the Gremlins ads, Gremlins clearly came out during Olympic season, because one of the ads has Stripe carrying the Olympic torch, and the ad is the unofficial Summer Games movie.
Yeah.
So, you know, and I remember when Gremlins came out, I remember, like you, Mike, I mean, like, I collected some of these ads, but I remember just like cherishing how they would lean into whatever pop culture relevance was going, whatever was happening at the time.
Well, that was
back, and it was only the big budget ones that would do that.
Well, that was back in the days when if you had a hit movie, you could open Memorial Day weekend or in June and play the entire summer. It wasn't like
the entire
even
summer.
Even now, yeah. Like even the Avengers, it's out, and then a month later, it's already starting to peter out. Back then, if you had a hit in the summer, it would go for months and months, and they would, just to keep it fresh, tie it in. Like Gremlins, I think I have three or four. There's like
you do,
one. There's a Back to School one.
Back to School, yeah.
And in Ad Astra, there's Superman 2. They have him tied to the 4th of July. So
That's right.
They got creative with that kind of thing. Child's Play opened in early November. It was still around at Thanksgiving, so they have like Chucky carving the turkey.
That's right,
That's one of the fun things. That's actually one of my picks for favorite ad. That's one of my picks for favorite ad is I remember when the Thanksgiving Chucky knife ad was in the newspaper.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the value to this book is incredibly strong. I just love, I mean, Mike, more than ever, I mean, I just find myself like not wanting to commit to any sort of like going to read something. And I just find myself sifting through this and reading these blurbs and just kind of walking down memory lane of the ads that I remember seeing, you know, in the New York Times.
Yeah, well, it's interesting you mentioned the Times because one thing I discovered, I think I talk about this in the intro, is the Times didn't advertise a lot of the schlockier stuff. And I discovered one of the things that spurred me to start collecting was when I discovered the Daily News and the New York Post. And they they advertise porn in those papers. And they would advertise the schlockiest stuff, like everything that opened on 42nd Street got an ad in there. And that's where some of the really... Like, I think Last House Part 2 is one of the first ones I found in the Daily News, which is the reissue of Twitch of the Death Nerve. So,
so another title for that.
Yeah. So that was one of the things, like, just seeing this stuff and knowing I couldn't see the film, but it's like, I got to have this ad at least to hold on to.
You know, it's funny. I'm looking at that one now, Last House Part 2, and the key art. So if you look it up, if you're listening to this, the key art at the bottom has these people, and one's like holding his hands. That's actually the art that's also used on the Messiah of Evil poster. So if you go look up the Messiah of Evil poster from years before, it's the same character. So it's kind of like our stock image of a girl being pulled down, that shitty key art you see in Redbox. It's almost the same concept at work, which, because as soon as I saw that, I was like, oh, is this a redo of Messiah of Evil? But it wasn't.
Shit, you're
and I
right.
thought that's pretty strange. Yeah, I've got that poster of Messiah of Evil. So I was like, what? It's just interesting how some of these things recycle the key art, I guess.
Well, regional distributors, especially Aquarius releasing, when they got a movie in, unless it was something that they cared a lot about and came up with new art for, they would just cut up ads for other stuff they distributed and patch it together into a new ad for the new film. I guess especially if that film didn't have anything very interesting in terms of the artwork.
Hmm. That's interesting, yeah.
Yeah, there's we talk about the Times. I remember, I found this recently when I went home to Connecticut, an old binder, school binder with my Trapper Keeper, and I had cut out the Return of Swamp Thing ad from the New York Times because it was big enough to fill like at least the bottom half of my Trapper Keeper. And I just remember like appreciating the New York Times that weekend for advertising a Wynorski movie.
I think that was the biggest ad a Wynorski movie ever got.
I know. But guys, I mean, like, you know, we kind of wanted to come to the homework assignment of like kind of going through these and kind of reflecting on some of our favorite ads. Who wants to kick it off?
Well, I'll say I didn't have that experience, what you guys had, really, because in New Zealand, we didn't really get these. The only times I saw this were either in Fangoria or comic books sometimes, but they weren't usually horror. So I didn't see a lot of these growing up. So I had some sent to me to look through. And I'd seen a lot of this stuff online, but there's two different types. There's the ones that you're talking about, which are like timely, and then there's ones that are just the movie, kind of like the VHS. But the one that I pulled up that really excites me is kind of like what I was just saying about Possession, is where it's something different. And I'm looking at the Holy Terror version of Alice, Sweet Alice, which I love stuff like that because A, that's a great title for that movie. Like that's the perfect title for the topic of that movie. So it's, I don't know if I even remember the story, but why it's changed. Alice, Sweet Alice definitely sounds more like a giallo, and it's Too Late for Prayers. But it's what's interesting about the ad, it's got all the kind of key art you would expect. But in the right-hand corner, then it has this like beauty shot on a box of Brooke Shields that's says introducing Brooke Shields, and it's really kind of cashing in on the fact that she's probably about to hit right in the culture. And it really ruins the ad, right? Like, it's like, you've got this really awesome art and then this really cheesy TV guide image. So I think things like that are pretty interesting. It's great. I kind of love that title, to be honest. Holy Terror. It's too late for prayers.
Yeah. Well, that was, I think Endless Love was just coming out at that point. And even when it was, cause it was first called Communion. And then
that's right. I remember it being called Communion. Yeah.
And then the distributor retitled it Alice, Sweet Alice, because they thought, oh, well, Carrie was a hit. We need the girl's name in the title. At that point, they tried to tie it into Pretty Baby, which Brooke Shields was in.
Yeah.
And then when Endless Love was coming out, they put it out again. A different company put it out as Holy Terror. So there were stages of trying to cash in on Brooke Shields' fame with that. And it's a great film. It stands on its own.
But, it's a great film. I love that film.
But yeah, they were completely trying to ride the Brooke Shields gravy train at that point.
Rob, you got anything?
Yeah, I got it. There's a few. One of the subjects I like is, and you already touched on a little bit, is I love tying it into the holidays, right? And so I always remember the Child's Play one, but I was skimming through the book and it's like, you know, I think American Werewolf in Paris opened on Christmas.
Ugh.
So the tagline's like, howl for the holidays or something along those lines, where it's like that would never be the tagline in any other context, but because of when it's coming out, that's kind of what makes it interesting. So I love the holiday themed kind of tie in ones for sure. And then something that I didn't grow up with, I didn't grow up with double features. I was at the age where we just didn't have those. That became more of a, when I went, you know, when I moved here to Los Angeles and went to retro theaters, or, you know, even the Two Boots in New York for a while, we're doing things
like
that.
God, I missed that place.
But I didn't, yeah, me too. But I didn't go to first run double features. And so those have been the most exciting for me to discover in Michael's book. A few that I think, well, this one's for Ryan, but there is an ad for a double feature of Student Bodies and Night School. And it's something like, you know, get laughs and scares, or whatever, you know, whatever the timing is. But you recently talked about both of those movies, so I was like, oh my God, it's like they programmed this for Ryan.
Well, that's an interesting story, you know? Because New York is probably the most expensive place to open a film. And Student Bodies opened, I think, that year in the summer, everywhere but New York, and bombed. And so they tossed it out on a
broken
with Night School in New York, try to get, you know, the two for the price of one in their advertising. And I love I got to find it here, because the Night School has one of my favorite taglines ever, and I don't want to screw it up, so I'm going to look it up here real quick. Where is that? Okay.
Well, he does that. That's a lot of people don't even below our age don't even realize that's where the whole B movie comes from.
Right? Oh yeah,
like people just forget that it's the second feature. It's the B movie, which was a lesser movie in quote marks. But our generation has come to love the B movie.
They were never a lot of times they weren't actually considered to be lesser known. If you look historically, that kind of evolved over time, but. During the original, that's just how they were referred to them. It was like, this is our A movie and this is our B movie. And it wasn't until they had been doing them for a while that the B movie started being the lesser. Actually, some of the original places that were doing double features like that, they would make the second movie the better one, so you would sit through the first movie to get there. So it was kind of like, you know, trying to get you there for the whole thing, because you'd eat more popcorn that way. But So, yeah, but it just over time became referred to as that. But they didn't start that.
Yeah, they'd be ready.
So I found the ad. The tagline for Night School has a report card on it, and it says, A is for apple, B is for bed, C is for co-ed, D is for dead, F is for failing to keep your head.
Oh, that's somebody put some work into that.
Yeah. That's like, that's up there with by sword, by pick, by axe, by box.
Oh, yeah. Hi. That's one of my favorites. Yeah. Old timer.
Well, and the other double bill that blew my mind was Aliens and The Fly. Like, the fact that you can go and see both Aliens and The Fly together, I was like, whoa, that's so pretty cool. And also, there's a solo Aliens ad in your book that literally says the scariest movie .. ever.
So that was my number one pick for my favorite, because I remember I remember seeing that, I think, in the Times, and like, it was sold. That was it. Like, that the scariest movie ever is a bold fucking statement. And it sold 2 movie tickets that night. I was so excited. And that's all it has to ride on. I mean, like, it's a black frame. It says, in 1979, Alien shocked audiences like no movie before and no movie since, until now. And it's like, that is a hell of a promise.
And the great
thing, I mean, luckily,
I remember seeing
Cameron delivered.
And at the time, it felt like the scariest movie ever.
Yeah.
It lived up to that billing.
Wow.
Yeah.
There were a few other, I think I actually had a few ads for Aliens, but they're all kind of the title on like a black field and then some tagline on the top. And that was the best line. So we decided to go with that one.
Yeah. Becca, what are some of your favorites?
Well, I actually didn't see a lot of the newspaper ads growing up. In my hometown, we had a local paper, the Winchester Star, and it ran ads for the local theaters, but our local theaters weren't going to play anything too crazy like that. We did have our drive-in, but it was only open for 2 months out of the year. Now, they would do double features. It was open in, or I guess, June, July, and August. The drive-in did play double features, and that's where I saw a lot of crazy stuff. Like, I remember seeing Wizard of Gore there as a double feature, and it was on the B side. But that said, they would not run ads in the magazine, in the newspaper, because that would have been like, they would just put the name. There would never be pictures included. So all of my like young marketing memories come from magazines to a degree, but mostly like TV promos is definitely where a lot of it was. So, but we'll get to TV promos, I'm sure.
I had Beyond the Aliens, I had flagged The Blob, 1988's The Blob, because it's a multi-part ad that had like these different images of a close-up of the blob, and then one was like, if it had a face, you could look it in the eye. If it had a heart, you could kill it. If it had a body, you could shoot it. If it had a mind, you can reason with it. And then it was the full ad, but it was the image of the guy being pulled into the sink.
Well, that was actually the second week ad. After it had been sold as a serious horror film and didn't do well, so they decided to go for the comedy aspect in the second week, and that didn't work.
Unfortunately, that sucks, because the Mike Clark USA Today blurb is, there should be an entry in every home fix it manual: never plunge the blob. Womp womp. But I do like the blob. And you have it on opposite of a page for The Seventh Sign, which is also a multi-part ad that was like teasing, and then a build up to the actual main poster.
Yeah, TriStar got into that for a number of films, like just that year. I think those were both 88 that those came out.
Yeah.
And they decided, let's try this, and neither one of them did well. So I guess they abandoned that pretty.
Because what they were saying about the history, I like about this kind of angle, is the fact that I take for granted that somebody had to sell these films, like the films I love. So Rob sent me one that he knew I would like, which was The Reflecting Skin. And it's like, because you grow up after it's out, I grew up after it's out, I just watch that movie and go, this is a great film. I never take the moment to go, how the hell would you have sold this? I remember the VHS cover, but
the VHS cover was just a boy sitting in a boat with like a harpoon above him, right?
Yeah, and a house with a harpoon and these jaws. But like, this is a very religious-y looking, looks like a boring drama from the picture. But the big words are plays like Blue Velvet crossed with Days of Heaven, and very big words, which is exactly what the movie is. So that review,
that's the most Elric review I've ever heard, which is why I took a photo and sent it to you.
Yeah, but I do appreciate that. Not that this is particularly sensational. I do quite like how they're selling it with him saying, his name. My name is Seth, and my summer vacation just started. The girl next door is a vampire. My pet frog just exploded. How's your summer? And I'm like, that is nothing like the tone of the movie at all, but I appreciate it. But I do like that element that I just don't think about. Oh yeah, you could have this great little movie, but how the hell do you get people to go in theaters to show up for it, right? Especially saying that's a little less of an exploitation piece, like something like that. So this is kind of cool to be able to see ads that it's like kind of brain opening, I'd say, which I like.
That is something that I absolutely love studying and focused a lot of my academic on. Was how films would get changed to be marketed as something else. And actually, one that I remember from your book is the Deep Rising ad. And even the television spots for Deep Rising, they really, Event Horizon, the Event Horizon ad and the television spots, they really tried to portray it as like a sci-fi film. And the fact that it was horror got really kind of buried underneath this like crazy sci-fi adventure thriller big thing. And that was in the ad that I saw in the book as well.
Well, that was a thing in the 90s. It's like there are also, if you look through Ad Nauseam 2, you'll see a lot of monster movie ads. Well, in Deep Rising is one. It's just a screaming woman's face.
It's just like, a screaming. That's why I was confusing it, because
you're in the ad. That's your selling point. And the Relic is the same way. They, you know, in the 90s was when horror was kind of a dirty word, and they were hiding when they were making a monster movie.
Yeah, the Relic is just Penelope screaming, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Well, you know, let me ask you, Michael, when you put the books together, because I don't know if you had planned out three books initially, but what I love about them is the first one is the 80s by year. Yeah. And then the second one is interesting to me because it's the 90s to the 2000s. And, you know, the 80s just feels like this glorious lost era to us. So it's kind of fun to hit any year there. Yeah. But what's interesting about the second volume is you can literally see the trends shift page to page. Like there's several ads in the 90s for similar type of movies. And then all of a sudden you're like, oh, now Scream came out. So here's all these type of movies. And now it's The Floating Head. It's kind of interesting to watch.
Yep. Everybody's standing in a row like models suddenly. Yeah.
But was it always the plan to go chronologically and start at the 80s?
My publisher, and I'm not going to pronounce his name right, Matthew Chonacki, he was really behind the idea of doing it as a chronological thing so you can really see the history of how these things developed. And the funny thing about following up the first book is you couldn't do just a book on the 90s because so few horror films came out theatrically. It would be, I don't know exactly how many pages, but really thin. And then in the 2000s, everything got a theatrical release, you know, if only in one theater. And so we actually had trouble kind of fitting everything from the 90s and the 2000s in one book. And yeah, what you say is true. And in Ad Astra, you can also see the trends because that covers 20 years as well. And you have the space operas, and then you had kind of hardcore sci-fi, and then you had all the action star horror with Schwarzenegger and Stallone and all that kind of thing. And you really can see the trends develop when you go over like a 20-year span that way.
You know, and at what point, because the second Ad Nauseam book ends around 2009. I mean, I don't even know, but at what point did the newspaper ad just kind of disappear?
I'd say around the mid-2010s. That's when I actually stopped collecting them because there just weren't as many anymore. Because advertising for movies all migrated online and, you know, something like the Village Voice in New York would advertise more of that kind of thing. Then they went under. And yeah, there just wasn't much to collect. So I'd say probably around 2013 or 14 was when it really started to peter out. And it's sad because one of the things I hear filmmakers complain about is now when you come up with an advertising graphic, it has to be one kind of big, bold image because it has to look good as a thumbnail on a VOD listing. You can't have these kind of intricate little designed ads like you had back then, you know, because you shrink that down and you can't tell what it is.
Well, the same even goes for film posters now. I've gotten this for all like both of the features now where you have to pick a central image so that when it goes to a thumbnail and people are flipping through on Netflix or Amazon that they see this image. It can't be something that's small and you can't see what it is and you have to click on it. You have to see like this core thing right there.
Did they tell you anything about taglines, about what kind of taglines, if any, that you can have?
No, actually, well, we had to do several. I mean, for the Lifetime film, I don't think there was any taglines, but I know for Creatures, they had us do several. And then, I don't even know how they pick and choose which ones they did where, but most films had several. Going back, I mean, even looking at like my favorite one from Pieces is, you know, exactly what it is, but you know, Pieces has like five other taglines with it too.
Cause that's the thing that the taglines got pretty elaborate. I think in Ad Astra, there's a little section on Universal where they'd have these essays running down the ad, like a couple of hundred words back in the 80s. And you certainly,
well, those were,
you couldn't do that on a little Netflix thumbnail now.
Oh, God, no. No, they look for brevity. And that was kind of like, 'tis the season, things like that. Like, we were just looking for, like, super, super short. But those long ones, like the Dawn of the Dead and the Demons ones, where it's just like, they will turn your cathedral, your they will turn your cemeteries into their cathedrals and make your cities will be their tombs and things like that. Those were always my favorite ones because they're like so descriptive and poetic. And yeah, I loved those.
Yeah.
I'm looking at I just had to stop because I almost did a spit take. The Blair Witch 2 ad, Book of Shadows. It was at the very top.
Great movie.
At the very top, it's got this this internet blurb. At an initial press screening for Book of Shadows, Blair Witch 2, internet film guru Harry Knowles said the following. And it's like a whole fucking essay at the top of this ad from Harry Knowles.
Power. Well, that's the thing also you see, especially in Ad Nauseam 2, is literally like at the beginning of the 90s, all of a sudden, critics' quotes became so much more important for horror films. And everything, like even little independent films, there'd be that critics quote in there somewhere, and it just got crazy as the 90s went on. And, you know.
Oh, and those are still a thing. I always loved that at Fango where I'd write a review, and then they would pull three words, meld them together, and it is great, Rebecca McKendry. And I was like, I didn't say that.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I'm looking at the ad for. Oh, I'm sorry. What did you say, Mike?
I know. I was like, I was misquoted too a couple of times. So.
Somebody has to ask Debbie Rashawn because the Rob Zombie's Halloween poster says the scariest Halloween movie yet, and Stacey Lane Wilson says better than the original.
Uh-oh.
Wow.
This will come back and haunt you, critics. These books will come back and haunt you.
I don't think Stacey will be haunted. She'll be like, Stacey, I don't remember saying that, whatever.
And then it'll be it.
Well, the interesting thing is some of these ads, too, remind audiences that the film is on its way out. Mm-hmm. Like for Scream 3, it's like, backed by popular demand, don't miss your last chance to see the most entertaining thrill ride of the year.
Because clearly
Scream 3 is on its way out.
Since it's dimension.
Yeah, thrill ride.
But you mentioned Halloween.
Yeah, I love that.
I think I actually have an ad for Halloween, The Curse of Michael Myers, where a critic says the best Halloween yet or something.
There's always somebody. There's always someone.
Well, I was gonna say my favorite trend that I noticed in across both books was every sequel had all new.
Yes,
clarify, this is a new one. All new, and literally everyone says best one yet.
Yes.
they always go for somebody to get that quote to be like, this is the best one yet. And, you know, I think I saw it on RoboCop 3, and I'm like, come on.
I also like I just like these ones where they're bringing things back into theaters. That's something that I didn't grow up with. Like, movies didn't come back. So Phantasm, it's like, it's back to kill you all over again. I'm like, that's so cool that you got to advertise your movie returning to a theater. I love that, you know.
And also, there's just the kind of cultural relevance. I mean, obviously, Halloween H2O came out at a time when Smashing Pumpkins was a thing.
Oh, yeah.
And the ad for H2O, this weekend, Jamie's back to smash some pumpkins and whatever else gets in her way.
Womp, womp.
Womp, womp. I mean, like, when these books came out, like I said, Mike, I mean, like, I'm thumbing through the 90s and the 2000s one, and I'm just, like, discovering new shit in here that I just, like, It takes you on like a little bit of a journey. I'm like looking at the Hills Have Eyes remake ad, and I'm like, I know exactly where I was when I first saw this newspaper ad. I know exactly where I was.
I got to say, I want to see Mike Newell's The Awakening a lot more than when I actually saw it, because this ad looks pretty badass. Like, if you saw that in the newspaper, you're like, oh, damn, I want to see that mummy movie. Yeah, unfortunately, it didn't do it.
It's funny you bring up The Awakening. I can remember seeing the trailer for that movie before. I don't even remember what it was. I have never heard more laughter at a horror trailer than that one.
Yes.
All it was the repeated tagline, they thought they had buried her forever, and people falling off of pyramids or off of scaffolding. So it's like, they thought they had buried her forever. By the end of this thing. The preview was better than the trailer was.
Yeah.
No, even just looking through earlier today, I suddenly wanted to watch Twice Dead again. Like, I fell for it again. And I don't necessarily remember liking it, but as I was floating through, I was like, oh, this is like a great, I should rewatch this movie. It's like my future kill where I feel like I've fallen for it. I fell for it last week.
Well, Future Kill had that great H.R. Giger poster.
Oh, it did. Yeah.
I don't think that ever.
That has come up a lot this month.
It has.
It's on the box.
Yeah, Future. This is Future Kill month on Shockwave.
I know. Yeah, there's a lot of Future Kill coming up over the last couple of months. Well, Mike, I mean, like, you know, have you run out? I mean, like, have you, what other kind of stuff have you collected over the years that needs to be compiled into a cool coffee table book?
Oh, yeah. We were talking about that earlier today. Like, we each have our weird collections. So, yeah. What else do you have?
I used to do ticket stub, movie stubs. When I went to SVA in New York, that's when I began collecting movie ticket stubs, but only the horror stuff.
Yeah.
But there was a point where I was like, you know, just got to let it go.
Yeah, I do barf bags. I have like the Mark of the Devil, the Tombs of the Blind Dead.
Are there that many barf bags?
Yeah, I probably have 18.
What?
And I don't do, like, everybody's like, oh, I got one from the screening of Raw, and it was literally like a sandwich bag, and somebody had written Raw on it in Sharpie. I don't do those. I want the ones that are like printed. But they did them. I think it may have started with like a Herschel Gordon Lewis film. It feels very Herschel Gordon Lewis-y. I know that he, you know, William Castle always stationed the nurse in the lobby and things like that. But somewhere around Mark of the Devil, like early 1970s, they started handing them out for a lot of kind of the more extreme grindhousey things. So I have them for a lot of not good movies. I have one for Snuff. So not great movie. That had a crazy tagline. Filmed in South America where life is cheap. That's Snuff for you. Yeah, intense.
The Night the Screaming Stopped.
No, I don't. Now I have a new hunt.
Because that was Zulawski's Possession, the cut version.
That was going to be the original title, yeah.
They did a barf bag for Possession?
I didn't know that, yeah.
I think reissued about 2 years later as The Night the Screaming Stopped, and I think it's even included in the book. There's a review somewhere where it played under that title, and there was a vomit bag given out. With that,
Whoever finds that, send that image to me. I want to see that.
Yeah, I want to see this. So yeah.
I would love to see somebody digitize that stuff.
But it's mentioned in there, I think.
Now, Mike, I know I used to do this when I worked at Fango. Did you keep press books? I have boxes of them in my garage.
I still have some of those too. Yeah, they're actually really handy for research because they have, especially going back to the 80s and 90s, there's info in there you can't find online.
Yeah, I know like most of the ones while I was there ended up in the Fangoria files. Like as soon as one would arrive, we would like meticulously like hold on to it and stick it in the files. But anytime they sent duplicates, I would take one. So I have one. This is like with permission. But this was like during the Tartan Asian Extreme, like the big Asian boom. So like I have ones for Wishing Stairs, Whispering Corridors. And they're these like elaborate. I have one for Audition, all these like crazy elaborate press books. I have one where it's like a dossier, like an insane asylum dossier. I can't even remember what film it is.
What was that for? I think I have that one.
I can't even remember, but it would have been around the same time because they stopped.
For Blood Knight?
It may have been. I remember that they were doing these for my first couple of years at Fango, and then they switched. We used to get EPKs as well. Those like giant VHS tape.
Oh, those gigantic 1-inch tape masters. Yeah.
I still have one of those, but I remember they switched over to those for a while, and then really quickly everything switched over to digital, and then the EPKs and the press packs just vanished. But
for about a year, they went to DVD press or CD press kits. So I have about a dozen of those in DVD cases. And I just have to say, my favorite press kit that I have in the collection is from Street Trash. And stapled to the front cover is a bag of gummy worms.
For a stretch, before I guess we figured out how to compress files, we were getting press kits on flash drives. And so all these different, like I have one from True Blood that's shaped like a cross. I have a whole bunch that are little like severed fingers from a variety of different films.
I have a thumb drive.
Yeah, I have a bunch of those and they all have different films written on them. I have a whole bunch of those. And comics, I remember, were doing that for a long time too.
Yeah, I went through. I recently went through a box since I've moved press kits and stuff, and I found a Ravenous press kit.
Ooh,
that came with a bag of jerky. Yeah, and that mysteriously had somehow dissolved in the plastic bag, which is very weird.
I was gonna say,
I did get jerky with the Crawl press kit this year. They sent like a whole bunch of stuff. Like I got a flashlight and a first aid kit, and it came with alligator jerky, which was not as good as I wanted it to be.
I'll tell you, but my favorite promotional item story is I came to the Fango office one day and there was a box that was about 5 feet long waiting for me. Do you remember Dead Silence, the movie James Wan made right
off
the
Jaw?
It was a wooden crate with a full-size replica of the dummy from Dead Silence in it, and Dead Silence emblazoned on the lid.
And what?
Whoa.
I still have it. I keep all of my other promotional items in it. A very handy store. But yeah, this thing, God knows what it cost them to ship all these. Clearly, I'm the only one who got one. This must have cost a fortune.
I was going to say, that's a funny thing. Like, just give people insight. I mean, like, basically what happens is, you know, the budget of the film is reserved for the budget of the film, but then there's an entirely different budget allocated for marketing, and that's generally handled by the distributor. And they go to great lengths to, like, you know, get creative, such as Dead Silence. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's interesting because that how they allocate that money is, you know, it's mostly all digital and now TV and theatrical ads. But, you know, they release those funds and release those ads little by little in the months leading up to the film. And they have to get creative. I mean, you know, sometimes they'll do full-on installations like the Niebold House, mm-hmm. when they recreated the It House here in L.A. Or, you know, like the Crate. Or I remember there was one time, what did I get? I remember it was Shark Night, I think. Oh. And they sent me an inflatable shark that had a motor on it with a remote control.
It floated around the room, right?
No, Becca, it floated out of my house and over the 101 freeway and off into the distance.
Yeah, because they were full of helium and they had a little motor.
No one told. I didn't read the directions. I just inflated it, and then I went out my front step because my dog was terrified of it. I went out on my front step, and I lived on Barham Boulevard. And this is kind of like Barham was kind of like the center of between Universal and Warner Brothers, and it's a very busy street near a very busy highway. And I just kind of let the shark go, and I started working the remote, and I was like, yeah, go shark, go. And then the helium just took the shark out, and I just see it floating over the freeway and into the hills of Hollywood. And I was like, well, that lasted all of 2 fucking minutes.
Kind of,
I think,
emblematic of how that movie did.
I never realized how much of like that movie swag that we used to get so much of I have around my house until like I have an aunt's tablecloth. It's not even horror, but for some reason they sent Fango an aunt's tablecloth that I have that I use all the time. It still says aunt's down at the bottom. But there was one day I was pulling Band-Aids out of the shelf and my daughter was like, Mommy, what does it say on the box? And I was like, well, that says all the boys love Mandy Lane. And it's like the box I use all the time. I have Freddy chopsticks that they did as a promotion.
The Cabin Fever Band-Aids.
Yeah, they did the same thing with Cabin Fever. But my favorite one, Mike, I think you were actually at the screening with me. When Beowulf came out, they did this massive screening, or Grendel, the big one.
Oh, it's Beowulf.
Beowulf, yeah.
The CG one, right?
Yeah.
Yeah,
they did a massive screening in Times Square. And I remember I was there with Mike Costell and they gave us all of this crazy stuff. And I came home with a fur blanket. It's like fur on one side and like plush velvet on the other. And I have Beowulf earrings, too, that they gave me that I've never worn. Someday it's going to come up and I'm going to be like, I'm going to whip out those Beowulf earrings. But it's Grendel. They have like little Grendel faces on them. But that blanket is plush.
Well, my favorites were for a little while, Lionsgate, ahead, I think when Tim Palin was there, used to have really elaborate stuff. Like, I have a rock pick with The Descent on it. I think when Saw 2 came out, I got an electric saw that I gave to my dad. And the best one was I got a refrigerated package delivered, and the ads for Hostel 2 just showed a bunch of red meat at one point. They sent out like steaks in like these frozen, like Omaha steaks or whatever. They actually sent me a frozen steak, and it was in the middle of the summer. And I had to figure like, how am I going home? I stayed in the city to go to a screening, and so I took a train at like midnight when it was at its coolest, and I got it in my fridge. So that was the crazy stuff Lionsgate used to do back
then. Oh my gosh.
Well, that was the thing. It was like these kinds of marketing tactics were the substitute for the newspaper ads. Like the newspaper ads eased out, you know, the publicists and the marketers, I mean, they had to like think of what is the thing that's going to get the online writers talking? You know, I mean, Elric, you were on Inside Horror, didn't you? Didn't you guys get any cool shit?
I didn't ever, even now, I hardly even write to any of the DVD companies. Like, I don't know why I don't do it. I guess I'm not, I didn't grow up in the doing the print stuff like you guys did, and therefore you guys knew how to maybe create those relationships. I've always just kind of drift along, but occasionally you did. I remember a couple of things along the way, but nothing as elaborate as what you're saying. Like the idea of getting a whole doll, it's like, Jesus, that's great.
But what you and I have had conversations about, Elric, that has changes recently is even how the press screenings would go. Because even when you and I were doing Inside Horror like 8 years ago, and it was the same for Fango and everything. You would do these press screenings where you would go and they would get you really drunk and they would feed you this amazing food and give you a swag bag, and then they would show you the movie when everybody was really drunk and happy. And then, like, we went to the screening for The Lighthouse. They didn't even have candy. Like, they came
out. Oh, that was amazing. Yeah, no.
It, we had stale popcorn.
Which one came out first? Was it Midsummer or Lighthouse?
Midsummer, they gave us food. Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's fancy. It's like you're drinking this fancy drink, looking at people going, why am I drinking this giant fruity cocktail?
Yeah, they got us pretty drunk.
And then Lighthouse comes up and it's like, yeah, there's three pieces of popcorn, you can fight over it, you scoundrels. You know, and it's like, oh, okay. But it kind of suited each movie. So.
A few of the ads in the 80s, even in the ads, it will say, if you go to the theater, you will get some piece of swag. When Demonoid came out, you could go and get the Demonoid diploma.
Oh,
one of my favorites is for Night of the Creeps. It said, "Be one of the first 50 people, you'll get a free creep prevention mask." And you better believe I was one of the first 50 people, and I still have this cheap paper surgical mask with Night of the Creeps printed on it.
Perfect for now. You gotta get a photo of that. You're
awesome.
Get back right now.
All-time favorite thing, and it's in the ads. You know, that's one of the things you can see in the 80s because that's how they got people into the theaters back then.
That's amazing. Well, Mike, I mean, like, you know, we had joked at the top of the show, you know, how TV Guide was such a resource for really cool ads and promotions. I mean, like, did you collect those as well or no?
I collected some. My biggest regret is I didn't collect regularly the ads for the made-for-TV horror films. I love to think someone out there has the TV Guide ads for Bad Ronald and Don't Look in the Don't Be Afraid of the Dark and all those other great TV movies from the 70s and 80s. I have some, but not enough to make a definitive collection. And I'm hoping someone out there will have them and they can do a book just of the TV Guide TV movie ads, because those were pretty amazing.
I would love that. Yeah, those would be fantastic. I mean, especially as horror was kind of starting to creep into television as well. I remember I used to collect all of the Buffy TV ads, because they would always generally take up one full slot of one page in there. That's awesome. Yeah. I mean, like, you know, Ad Nauseam 2 and Ad Nauseam 1 and Ad Astra. Mike, can you get these on Amazon? Where can you find all these?
Yeah, you can get them on Amazon. You can also go to 1984publishing.com. I can't remember. I think there may be some signed copies still available there. I'm not sure. Nice. But yeah, they're available on a lot of online bookstores, and they're in specialty stores as well, like Forbidden Planet. I know that was available at Book Soup out there at a certain point.
Yeah.
So any store that still carries esoteric film books, they should be out there.
Excellent. Well, this is definitely Shockwaves approved. And Mike, where can we find you? Are you on the socials?
I am on Facebook. I'm not on Twitter, sadly. But you can find me on Facebook for sure.
All right. Excellent.
Well, and where all are you writing for now? Because I know see you still in Fango, but where else can we read your stuff?
I write for Rue Morgue on a regular basis. I do a lot for their website. I write a lot for Birth Movies Death. I know they're on hiatus right now because of the whole thing with the Draft House. I've been writing for Time Out New York. So, it's mostly Fangoria and Rue Morgue. That's where I still do all my horror stuff. So, you can find me not so much on the Fango website, but in every issue for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, great. Mike, thanks for coming on the show. Well,
thanks so much for having
we're
me.
We're going to have you back. Yeah. No, of course. And again, Ad Nauseam 2 and Ad Astra are now available. Check them out.
And send us a picture of you wearing that mask.
Yes.
I need to see that.
I know we still have it. I just have to dig it up. Just as a parting thing, my other favorite promo thing from the 80s was I went to a press event for From Beyond, and I got a plastic sun visor with a pineal gland sticking out.
Yes.
I've seen a picture of you with that on. Yeah,
there's a photo of me with that on that's on. I think it was my avatar on the Fango website.
That was it. I was like, I feel like I've looked at that a lot. Yeah. That was it.
It may still be online somewhere, but I'll see if I can find that creeps prevention mask.
That'd be great.
Especially these days. It can come in handy.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's great. All right. Well, listeners, thanks again for tuning in.
Stay safe, everybody.
Hopefully we're getting you through these rough times. Yeah. And because we didn't give you a proper send-off, Elric, would you like to say goodbye to our listeners this week?
Did I say that last time?
You did. After we wrapped up, you were like, "Oh, are we over?
Are we not going to say goodbye?"
And we were like, "Goodbye."
We did, and so Elric, you can say goodbye this week.
I don't want us to forget our manners, but you know what? I'm going to throw it to Rob. Rob, say goodbye for us this week.
Goodbye, everybody.
See, I knew that would be good. All right.
Fangoria and Blumhouse present Shockwaves. Shockwaves is a member of the Fangoria Podcast Network, hosted and produced by Rob Galuzzo, Elric Kane, Ryan Turek, and Rebecca McKendry. Sound recording, mixing, and editing by Ernie Hurtado. Music by Gregory S. Burkhart. Logo art and design by Aaron Crawford. For Fangoria, Dallas Sanye, Phil Nobile Jr., Jessica Safa-Vamare, Brandon Wynardi, Natasha Pasetta, and Rob Galuzzo.